from the internet. It's Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me is John Lindemann.
I shall henceforth be referred to as John Yu.
It's awful.
Greg Leahy. And James Jones.
John's already ruined the show.
That's why we have him here. So it's great to be back and talking with all you guys again. Last week we had E3. If you haven't caught up on all the shows, I would understand. I think we published 6 podcasts last week from E3, and plus there was the Homecast, which is over on the Newscast feed. We had a lot of fun at E3. We got to see some really cool stuff, and we're going to talk about it here in a minute. But I'm very glad to have Greg and John back on here, and I'm actually really curious to hear what you guys thought of the show and if you have any questions for James and I. But first, I do have a little programming note. We said a couple weeks ago that we were going to finish up the Perfect Dark Retroactive this week, and after some consultation with each other after the big show, and looking at the mountain of listener mail that we got, a lot of which is really good stuff that we do want to talk about, we just decided it'd be better to push it back one more week. It'd give us more time to catch up, because also a ton of games came out last week, oddly enough, with the eShop and everything. So we're all kind of backlogged, I think, right now, and we're struggling to catch up on Perfect Dark. So we're going to give it one more week. So next episode, I promise, we're going to finish Retroactive on Perfect Dark. We're going to talk about the single-player campaign, and it's going to be really fun. I've started in on it, and I think there's a lot to say, and I hope you do too. So, of course, the thread is still open if you are still playing along, or if you hadn't had a chance and you want to try to catch up, now you've got a little extra chance. Throw your thoughts in there, and we will pull some out and read them on the show next week.
So, in summation, join us in 4 weeks when we finish off Perfect Dark.
Hell yeah.
Nope, I'm nipping it in the bud next week. It's over. Mm-hmm. I don't care if I'm the only one. If I have to go solo,
I already beat the game, Johnny. Come on.
Now, before we get into new business, being that E3, there were a lot of games played there and a lot of announcements and things, a lot of questions left to be answered, I thought that people might have a more urgent interest in that stuff than what we played after we got home or what Greg and John played last week. So I thought we would start off with a quick feature, an E3 overview, and sort of just go around here and kind of wrap up the show. And then we'll have some listener mail later on in the episode that will come back to some of this with maybe more detail. But first off, you know, I mean, we got to play Wii U. We saw all the new stuff for 3DS. We saw a little bit of stuff for Wii, maybe more than I expected. And James, I'm kind of curious to hear what your overall thoughts are.
At the time of the show, I felt like things were going really well. They kind of did a very good showing. But that was while I was still in the echo chamber. Once I sort of stepped out, I began to kind of question the efficacy of their message. Once I began to understand how it was perceived outside of that sort of environment. Mm-hmm. What I've found in retrospect is that maybe they didn't do quite as good a job as I thought they did. Now, it's not to say that what they announced wasn't great. I think the Wii U is incredibly capable, and I'm excited about it. I just don't think they did a good job with their message.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all were surprised at the difference in what Wii U actually was, pleasantly surprised at the difference in what it actually was once we got to play it versus what was shown in the press conference, which is the extent of what most people know. Maybe not the people listening to the show, but most people, if they even know what Wii U is, they're only going to know what was shown at the press conference, which means they haven't even seen the console itself.
No.
And they probably think that controller is a lot bigger and heavier than it really is, and they don't really know what all the buttons are on it, and they don't really have a great idea of what the games look like or what you can do with all that stuff.
Well, we don't have a great idea of what the games look like, because apparently they weren't even showing games on full-spec hardware. I mean, now the report is that what was out there was on underclocked system development kits. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Other reports have been that there were games that were in a state that could be shown, but Nintendo pulled them because it didn't look good enough.
Well, and the sucky part about that is you got to figure Nintendo's probably resealed the vault at this point.
At least until TGS.
Yeah, so for those developers who did have something that they wanted to show, now they're probably not going to be allowed to show that because E3's over and Nintendo wants to wait for the next blast of information.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That sucks. I mean, I feel like they've shown enough about this system that, you know, if you're a third-party developer and you want to announce a Wii U game, you should be able to show screenshots for it. And I don't think that's going to be allowed for a while.
We don't have any screenshots. I mean, ultimately, we don't. In fact, the sizzle reel is basically non-Nintendo stuff.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where post E3 drone, their narrative started to sort of fall apart, because what they were showing in their own press conference didn't come from their own console.
Well, I didn't think that the Batman Arkham City stuff that they showed was running on Wii U hardware.
Well, the fact that that even came out is kind of silly.
It's kind of ridiculous that they would do that. I was actually really surprised at that. It's kind of bullshit.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's the kind of thing that whenever there's like the new Sony console announcement, there's always the, okay, which one of these videos is real?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's not a situation you expect from a Nintendo press event.
Well, okay, if we're comparing this to the Killzone 2 video from 5-6 years ago, the difference between showing footage from multi-platform games on that was coming from an Xbox or a PlayStation or a PC, most likely PC in some cases, but the difference between showing that to announce a whole bunch of Wii U games and showing a 2-minute trailer that was done in CG is that when these games actually come out on Wii U, they're going to look better than they do on Xbox and PlayStation. Not like in the case of Killzone 2, where it comes out looking worse than this very idealistic CG trailer that they showed everybody.
Doesn't that hurt them, though? Because wouldn't they want to not give the impression that, yeah, our games are going to look just like the Xbox version?
I'm sure they were more concerned about letting people know these games are coming to the system.
Yeah, but they should have said, hey, these aren't necessarily Wii screenshots.
They could have maybe said that. I just assumed that they weren't. Maybe I'm that cynical.
It was the way I read it. It was just like, these games are coming to the Wii U. Now, mm-hmm. those are the games. I mean, that is what they look like. They probably won't look much different on that system. It's just, you take it as representative.
And by the way, the Wii U version of some of those games didn't actually exist on that day. And they probably don't today.
Yeah, that especially because we don't know how far away it is. It could be a year. It could be the better part of 18 months.
Actually, I do want to remark on this since we're on the topic. I think the fact that they showed things like Batman Arkham City actually is a good indicator that this might actually be coming earlier in the year than you think. Because that Batman comes out in October, I think, this year.
Yeah.
So they're not going to release that 11, 12 months later.
Yeah, I mean, according to Sega, I think somebody at Sega said that it was coming out in summer 2012.
They did, the spring, summer, kind of is what they said. That. But the problem is that Nintendo might well intend that and fall short. They've did it with the 3DS. And even when they did release it, it was still with their flies unzipped. I mean, they might have every intention of launching it that soon and complete. Because I mean, clearly they haven't got a lot of software. They've got less software in the pipeline, seemingly, than they did for 3DS. So,
well, it's going to be easier for them to meet their software launch targets because of all these multi-platform games.
Yeah, I mean, and also the fact that, you know, it's not going to be like light years beyond PS3 and 360, you know, 50% more powerful or whatever.
Yeah, when they all, you know, they're going to be using the same engines and everything. I mean, this thing is going to be easy to put your games on. Mm-hmm. It might be difficult to design an exclusive title for this, and those, like the really good examples of that might come a lot later. But in terms of like prepping a few easy ports, high quality, bump up the graphics a little bit, put a map on the controller, that's not going to be very hard to do for this launch, especially if you've got 3 months after the other versions come out before the system launches. I think that's going to be plenty of time to put together a nice polished port of those games. And if you're a primarily a Nintendo fan, or if you're really excited about the advantages of it being on Wii U, then maybe you can wait 3 months. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to wait a year to play Batman on another system. I'm not. I'm playing that game on my Xbox, motherfucker, this fall. Now, I might play it again on Wii U if they give me a really good reason to do so, but I certainly wouldn't sit around waiting 12 months just to play a slightly better version of it. I don't care what you put on the controller. But I think the fact that it's not that much more powerful than the current HD systems, number one, it's not that surprising. I think most of us were pretty realistic about that. There might have been some people who were expecting this to be like a massive generational leap over the other systems, but at this point, it's not even clear what a generational leap in technology would be, because we don't have anything to compare it to with the other guys. And quite frankly, I just think it would be naive to expect Nintendo to shell out for the equivalent of a PS3 in 2006, you know, like this insane overpowered thing that they're going to lose money on. Yeah. That's not what they're going to do. But I mean, I think it's actually in a good place for Nintendo because it does make it easy for the third parties to support them in a way that they couldn't before. And I think third parties would love to sell their games on a Nintendo system. They just haven't really been able to do it very effectively in the past for a lot of different reasons. So if you take away some of those obstacles, I think they're going to jump at it. And it looks like they are already. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, I think Microsoft and Sony are so happy about the system coming out when it is at the power level that it is, because what it means is that they can continue. See, it works the other way too, because if you're a third party and you want to make sure that you have software on the new hotness, the new Nintendo console, the one new system on the market, and it's fairly easy for you to also make slightly different versions for the existing systems, you're going to be even more likely to do that. So what it means is it's going to keep the third parties at bay. It's going to keep all the developers and publishers at bay in terms of demanding a new hardware generation. Because mm-hmm. as I've said many times, Microsoft and Sony right now do not want to sell you a new box. Yep. They don't want to make a new box. They don't want to pay for the development and the manufacturing of a new box that they're going to lose $200 a unit on. Because they're making money hand over fist on hardware and software right now, especially Microsoft.
Well, I mean, and also the fact that 360 and PS3 sales are going up year on year. One of the things I question with Nintendo is their kind of market timing in this, right? Because right now you have a lot of people that maybe never had 360s and now they've come down in price. Hey, they're finally going to buy one. All their friends have, you know, Black Ops and everybody loves Black Ops and everybody's playing it. I don't know if they would choose, like say a year from now, I don't know if people would choose a 360 because it's cheap and getting cheaper and there's a ton of games out for it. All their friends have one. All their friends are playing Call of Duty, whatever. Modern Warfare 3 or Modern Warfare 4, they're already playing it. I don't know if people are going to choose that or go with Nintendo. None of their friends probably have it. They probably all have 360s or PS3s. I don't know. Nintendo's kind of coming in at a weird point.
Well, it depends on how much you place on the online experience. But, I mean, Nintendo has two things on their side. First off, their system is not going to be expensive. I mean, it will probably cost a little bit more than the current price of Xbox and PlayStation, whatever that is at the time it comes out.
Yeah.
So by the time this thing comes out next year, I would expect the hard drive version of Xbox to be about $250. It's at $300 right now. And I would expect Sony to have some version of the PlayStation 3 that will be $250 by that point. And Nintendo, based on what we've seen, could possibly launch the Wii U at $250 as well.
I doubt
$300 is more likely, I would say, but $250 I don't think is unreasonable. I don't think it's completely impossible. So, hey, actually, before we get to proper new business, I do want to talk about 3DS for a minute and its presence at E3, because I came away, I was going into E3, you know, I knew that I was probably going to buy a system right before it or right after it. I ended up going with right before because I wanted to do Street Pass and I wanted to get the eShop on the day it came out and stuff like that. And I'm glad I did. I really enjoyed all that stuff. And I'm enjoying it now too. But I was really hoping to see that the environment on 3DS in terms of just everything that's available and everyone's attitude towards it would really come out a lot rosier after E3 than it was going in. Because going in, 3DS was seen as having a pretty slow launch, a very bad post-launch vacuum of good games, and not a whole lot of innovative ideas on the horizon. And I still feel like that's pretty much the same story coming out of E3. I think Nintendo's lineup for it's pretty good, you know, with Mario and Luigi's Mansion. Mario Kart looks excellent. I think all that stuff will do fine, but from the third party side, we really didn't see very much that was inspiring. And I was surprised. I mean, I did see one or two games that I thought were creative and looked really neat, you know, the kind of smaller titles that I talked about always looking for when I go to E3, and I saw a couple like that, and those got me excited. But what I didn't see were any kind of like major third-party platform releases outside of basically Resident Evil and Metal Gear Solid, which everybody thinks looks bad, or controls poorly at least.
It's not as terrible as after I played it the second time as my first impression, but it's not good.
Well, Resident Evil's really, I mean, Revelations is ridiculously impressive. I thought that was my 3DS game of the show. But outside of those two titles from two different publishers, EA had jack shit. Ubisoft had nothing. Nothing. Namco has nothing but Pac-Man and Galaga, and I guess Tekken, but that was only like a 2-second trailer.
Well, and
Ace Combat
game. Yeah. Oh. So Namco is probably the biggest third-party supporter they have right now.
I just feel like maybe these companies have a couple games that are smaller, that they're not going to promote, but certainly they don't seem enthusiastic about the platform at all.
They have licensed games.
Last year, it seemed like they were. You know, I mean, the way Nintendo unveiled 3DS at E3 last year, they had this wall of logos from all the third parties, all the different game titles that they announced, and some of that stuff has been canceled, some of it came out at launch, but the rest of it, it's like, where did it go? Where is that support?
A lot of the companies listed were Japanese companies, and there did seem to be a smaller foot presence of the Japanese companies at the
E3. Well, I think you look at it, you know, in Japan, the portable software routinely dominates the charts. Obviously, that's mostly the PSP at the minute, but, you know, even with 3DS, you know, a lot of the big titles that have come out recently have charted well, and, you know, whereas in America, the DS market weakened quite severely in recent years. PSP obviously has been a non-starter, especially in software, for a long time. So it may be a sort of wait and see approach that, well, you know, if you're going to take handheld gaming into a more premium place while, you know, everything seems to be going in the other direction with smartphones and everything, we're going to wait and see before we commit a bunch of our development resources to developing titles for it.
What I would point out is companies like Atlus, who we know have multiple 3DS games in development, were in a cubicle. And I'm curious if maybe these Japanese companies are holding off for TGS.
Did we talk to them? I mean, were they showing that stuff?
Atlus was showing Catherine.
Yeah, that's all, though. They weren't showing any of their 3DS
stuff. Right, I mean, they were doing appointments only, and it was for Catherine.
Anyway, so James, I mean, do you think I'm off base with what I'm saying about 3DS at E3?
There were a lot of games for show in Nintendo's upstairs patio, but ultimately, it didn't feel like... that was it. That was 3DS for the show, unless you wanted over to Konami's booth or Square's booth.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you would have thought that it would have been kind of 3DS's big coming out party, but it really wasn't that at all.
I feel like your system is in bad shape when 90% of the games at E3 for it are in the manufacturer's booth. Because we saw that same thing with Wii a few years ago. Do you remember the year where we went to all these appointments and they all said either we didn't bring the Wii version or you'll have to go to Nintendo's booth to play it?
Ugh.
And that was kind of the beginning of the end for third-party development. I mean, if it's not a big enough deal that they actually want to show it at their own booth, then I think you've got a problem.
Well, the thing is that earlier in the life cycle, there is the capacity for if, for instance, you know, you do have stuff like Mario Kart and Super Mario spurring a big sales surge coming out of the end of this year, then there's time for them to adjust their development priorities towards the 3DS if they feel there's a market that's then been created. Whereas with the Wii, you were already past that point where, you know, everyone knew we had a huge install base, but still they didn't really think there was much fertile ground there.
I do want to say Sega actually had a pretty good 3DS showing. In their booth, they had Sonic versus Mario and Shinobi, and they also had Crushed. So they had at least four 3DS titles. Maybe I might even be forgetting one.
That Sonic versus Mario, though, is...
Oh, sure. I know.
It's
a travesty.
The worst game I've ever played at an E3.
Yeah,
it's
I mean,
so
it's,
bad.
Let's not speak of it. But Sonic Generations looked okay, and Shinobi looked good.
This is the Olympic Games one, right? This
yes.
is not the new...
They are taking a 3DS crap all over the London Olympics.
All right, well, James and I have talked plenty. John and Greg, I'd love to get your thoughts on the whole thing and you know, if you have anything you want to ask us.
I didn't get to see it live, as usual, and I try and watch it as live later that day, but, you know, just getting to somewhere where they stream it, you're probably going to stumble across quite a lot
right.
of the stuff. So that takes some of the surprise out of it. But then there wasn't that many surprises in it. Obviously,
no.
they chose to tell us about Super Mario back at GDC, and they, you know, all the stuff about the screen and the controller was out there. So, you know, it wasn't sort of one of those sort of really jaw-dropping kind of presentations. But I think the way they presented the new system, they did fumble it a little bit, you know. I mean, I thought it was a sort of beautiful irony of the fact that 6 years on from the last time that they unveiled a console for the very first time, that was in 2005, the revolution. All we had was the system casing, and this time they had it, but they didn't want to show it to you. You know, like, it was so strange. You know, or you would have thought they would have just started with, "And this is the new system." and shown the thing, and then quickly moved into the controller. But as it was, definitely, as James kind of alluded to, outside of the context of E3, there were a number of people who were confused as to whether it was a peripheral for Wii, mm-hmm. because they, I think a combination of the way it was presented, not showing the actual physical hardware that much, and also because of the name. I mean, you know, the thing about Wii U, however much it might roll off the tongue well or not, you know, like a bit of sandpaper in your mouth.
Yeah.
The real thing there is it's just like a modifier, you know, like DSi.
Right.
It doesn't really sound necessarily like something that transcends the current platform.
It feels like they're marketing it rather like the DSi. That's a good comparison.
Yeah, I agree. And beyond that, Greg, when they showed all these demos, and this is in the videos too that went out, of the people playing with their Wii remotes or even a classic controller on the same game as the Wii U controller, and they don't show the console, it's very easy for people to think that this is just a new controller for my Wii.
Yeah.
And especially since a lot of people think of the Wii remote as being the Wii. Like when my mom says she wants a Wii so she can play bowling, she doesn't even know that there's a box that you put a disc into. Mm-hmm. That means nothing to her, you know?
Yeah, well, also the fact that, you know, it was very confusing to watch. I mean, a couple of things confused me. Okay, first, when they talked about Wii U, I was like, okay, well, this can't be the new console because the new console is just going to have an iconic name. Wii U must be some sort of service. Is it something like maybe some kind of Wii thing that they're pitching to students and schools? I was like, you know, like...
Actually, John, I'm going to tell you what you were like, because I just happened to have some text messages from Mr. John Lindemann here.
Absolutely.
Regarding the Wii U. Me telling John to play Picture Lives or watch Picture Lives alone. Oh, it reminds me of ESPNU.
Yep. That's what the first thing I thought of. I was like, what?
Quote, worst name ever, but at least I can play Arkham City on it a year from now.
True.
I have the text Dicks in 3D from John. I don't know what that means.
That's from the Kinect thing with the finger drawing, right?
I don't
that's
know.
That's how you draw dicks in 3D.
I mean, this branding issue is something that people have talked about. Well, Johnny, you've talked about it with respect to 3DS. That is it a bit too close to the DS? To people who aren't, you know, regularly sort of proactively seeking information about the topic, not understand that, you know, it's not just a DS that has stereoscopic display.
But at least there, I think, even if it does sound a lot like a DS...
Well, it looks a lot like one.
And it looks like one. But the fact that it has 3 in the name, that has 3D in the very name, tells you exactly what it does. And it tells you exactly how it's different from the previous DS. Wii U, that U is so abstract. I still don't know what it's for. I mean, whatever Reggie said is complete horseshit up on stage.
Yeah, it was a slightly tortured explanation.
It's about you.
It's still Wii because you play together, but then you've got the screen in the controller that you see, so it's Wii.
But then you can still use the Wii controllers. It's just weird.
Yeah, so, I mean, the U in that name tells you absolutely nothing about what this is. And so
no.
I don't think this is nearly as good. I think 3DS is actually... Just in terms of linguistics, I think it's one of the most genius, you know, successor names I've ever heard.
It's certainly elegant.
Yeah.
I think there is a legitimate point there that some people don't necessarily appreciate that the 3DS is the generational leap, if you want to use that, ahead of the original DS. It doesn't play your old games in 3D. You know, like maybe some people think that and they don't want to pay the money to do that or something. That there's that sort of sentiment out there, but I think that problem, if it exists for 3DS, is more acute or will be more acute for the Wii U.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, for you look at two of Nintendo's biggest successes following up, where you had the Super Nintendo and the Game Boy Advance. You know, those are very clearly names. It's like, this is going beyond this very successful brand that we already have. You know, it's the next in line. It's the next step up. This sounds a bit of a side brand. And I think the problem they may have is that if they try and sell it mainly on the basis of the controller, which certainly from the presentation, we would infer that that's going to be their approach. That's how they're going to try and get you to buy it instead of, you know, the PlayStation or the Xbox. I fear that some people who don't appreciate the fact that it's, you know, also a big step forward in terms of technology and other respects, might be a bit reticent. So, well, hang on a minute. Why can't I just have this new controller for my Wii?
Yeah.
Why do I have to pay $300 or more, whatever it would be, to buy a new box to just buy the controller if that's the selling point of the console? Those kinds of expectations going into it might affect their willingness to purchase it. So I think they've got a real problem. First of all, I would recommend they reconsider the name. As again, yes. not because, I mean, yeah, for me personally, I don't care. I certainly wouldn't care if I didn't have to say it on this podcast.
That's
all the
why
time.
I care, because yeah. I have to talk about it.
If I didn't have to talk about it, I think I will probably refer to it as simply the U, so it will conjure images of Vinny Testaverde in the 80s wearing his army fatigues.
I can get with that. I can definitely get with that.
I think that's a nice bit of short.
Well, that's because you're in the tank, John. You don't count.
Well, I think that they would have just been. I mean, if Apple can call the iPad 2 the iPad 2, why not just call it the Wii 2?
Seriously.
Or call
because
it
Wii HD. That sounds even worse.
No, it doesn't.
But to me, that's not really the point. Wii 2 might sound bad, but at least it does what it says on the tin for me. You know, like that. Yeah. That is unambiguous. Super Wii. You know, I love James doesn't like that one. He likes to make his funny little groaning noises when that is said. But that would work. You could compromise between Super Wii and Wii U to Uber Wii.
Oh, Jesus Christ, stop.
You just call it Wii HD. I mean, that tells everything you need to know.
I agree. I think Wii HD is a pretty good name for this.
I think the problem with Wii HD, though, is that if you've got the 3DS problem of like, oh, does this just play my old games in 3D?
Yeah.
Wii HD, does it just play my old Wii games in HD? Which you don't want them to think that, because it won't.
It won't, but you know what it will do? And I can almost guarantee this right now, today, mark your calendar. The Wii U will play backwards compatible Wii games on the controller.
Yeah, well,
I don't see why not.
So Johnny just made a guarantee, so we're going to go ahead and write the news story now that didn't happen.
Here's why I know that they're planning to do this, because there's a sensor bar on the front of the controller. You can't actually use this if someone's holding the controller and playing with the joysticks on the sides. So you would have to set this thing down and then point a Wii remote at it. And you would only do that if someone's watching something on the TV and you want to play Mario Galaxy on the controller.
Well, they did show that golf thing that would use a sensor bar in that scenario too, though.
That's not using a sensor bar, it's using Motion Plus.
I mean, I think if you go beyond the whole naming issue, though, just more broadly, the marketing, it seems like it's a lot more difficult than it was for Wii. The hook is much less clear and intuitive, and demonstrating it is going to be difficult. I think, you know, in game stores or in malls or these tours or whatever they're going to do, demonstrating this asymmetric multiplayer kind of stuff and all this, it's not as easy as it was with the Wii, which obviously they did well. But considering, you know, the 3DS has similar but different problems and that hasn't gone quite so well yet, you know, we talked about all the marketing challenges that they had with 3DS, and I haven't been impressed with the way they've grappled with them so far. They're going to have to get better at marketing.
And I think the window of opportunity to show 3DS trailers before 3D movie theater showings is maybe shrinking now. So it might be too late to take advantage of that.
It's still strange that they didn't do that.
Well, at least now they can do the download from the eShop, if it fucking worked for me.
And then, I mean, 3DS-wise, I guess for me, the biggest thing was Super Mario, because what was intriguing about it was just that it was nothing like what I imagined it was going to be, basically.
You and me both.
Miyamoto had been out there saying, "But well, it's like a cross between Galaxy and Mario 64. Maybe there's some senses in which that is true, but I mean, the headline seems to be that this is basically a 3D version of an old school Mario game.
No, it's not. It is Mario Galaxy on your 3DS.
Well, first of all, there's no health meter. You shrink, you die. You know, it's old school that way. The power-ups are persistent, not timed like Mario Galaxy.
I'm telling you, Greg, I mean, from what I played, I thought it played much more like Galaxy than any other Mario game. It plays like a slower version of Galaxy with a fixed head-on camera angle.
But it doesn't seem to... The fact that you've got persistent power-ups, the fact that you've got the old-school health system...
I agree, and I also played it, so...
I know it seems like that on paper, but it doesn't feel like that when you play it.
The point is, it's between Galaxy and the old games, not Galaxy and Mario 64, which is completely in the other direction. So that's why it was a surprise to me, because it's not more explorative by the look of it by any means. You've got a level flay of flagpoles at the end of the level. You know, like the old games, they haven't even got the stars conceit anymore.
Mm-hmm. I concur.
It seemed to be just getting further and further away from Mario 64 as they go. But what's interesting to me about that, judging from what everyone said about playing the game, is, well, is it really a benefit for it to be a 3D Mario game anymore? I mean, if you have to slow the movement down because you're in these sort of cramped fixed perspective cameras, mm-hmm. if you have to take away the ability of the Tanuki suit to fly mm-hmm. because it creates too many game design problems in 3D, then what is the point of having it be in 3D? Well, you could just say, well, let's make it more like Wario Land for the Virtual Boy and actually be side-scrolling, but we use the depth for other things. It just seems like this might be a bit of an unhappy medium between those two things. You know, I think Galaxy struck a nice balance between, yeah, obviously it was still very much a descendant of Mario 64, but it was getting closer to the sort of ethos of the old games because it was more linear and more broken up mm-hmm. into little challenges. This, as I said, needs to go further in that direction. Like the run button as well is another thing. You know, it's very much charting a course towards the old games, maybe because of the sales disparity between New Super Mario Brothers and Galaxy. I mean, you yeah. have to think those kind of commercial motives may be coming into play. But from what everyone said, you know, they seem a bit unhappy with, you know, he seems a bit sluggish or this, that, you know, you do wonder whether it's going to work out. So, you know, with EAD Tokyo, you've got a certain level of confidence. You would certainly think they would be able to get the mechanics right at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. But especially if this whole thing that Miyamoto likes to talk about all the stereoscopic 3D is going to help you judge your jumps and all that. One seems to be sold on that yet, at least in a short form. So if that doesn't materialize at all, again, you ask yourself, game design wise, did this justify itself?
Greg, I think you're right about Super Mario, and I think the phrase unhappy medium almost perfectly describes how I feel about that game, because it's not as fast and exuberant as Galaxy. It doesn't have that sort of magical flair to it, you know? And yet it also doesn't really capture the nostalgic feel of the old Super Mario games, and quite frankly, I think I'd probably be a lot more excited about things like persistent power-ups and jumping on flagpoles if we didn't already have that in the parallel New Super Mario Brothers series, which is ongoing and had a new game at this E3 for Wii U.
Indeed.
So we're not exactly starved for that style of Mario gameplay, so I'm not really sure what they're getting at with the Super Mario on 3DS. It doesn't really feel like its own thing, and it doesn't feel right, and I do think they'll tighten that up, but man, nobody really felt like that it was really tuned properly. So,
no, I mean, I feel like I had less of an issue with it than some people. I thought it was, it felt good, but didn't feel like Galaxy good.
I just don't think the run button works in 3D.
I think it could work just fine. I just don't think it worked in that implementation as well as it should have.
Yeah, I guess that is something different for them. You know, I mean, they've done two Galaxy games, but that's with, you know, typical analog control. Maybe it is something they'll fine tune. You'd certainly hope so. But also, I hope, you know, the one thing about the Galaxy games is that because of the setting and the kind of philosophy of those games, yeah, they are incredibly imaginative. They will surprise you and delight you with their sort of visual and gameplay variety. I do hope in moving towards kind of trying to conform to the classical Mario style, they're not going to take that away from themselves too much. Because mm-hmm. that, again, would seem like a price not worth paying when you've got a new Super Mario Brothers series that's very successful and already exists.
You know what? There's an interview with Koizumi that came out, where it's about this game, obviously, but it does sort of give sort of an insight into the thought processes that go into being the development lead on a Super Mario game. Even though EAD Tokyo has only been around for the two Galaxy games in terms of Mario games,
yeah,
he's obviously worked on other Mario games prior to that.
Yeah, yes,
and I mean, some of the conversation comes around some of the creative solutions they've had in the past, like the shadow silhouette showing up in sunshine, because in a 3D game, you might not always be in the front of everything. So I have some level of confidence as I read the interview that they can make this work, but they don't actually get to how he's going to handle the specific challenges of 3D, which is why it's a frustrating interview to read, to be honest.
Yeah. I didn't really think the 3D display added anything to that game, and I didn't think it would. It looked good, and we have an email question about this later, so I'll save that rant, but It certainly didn't make the platforming any easier. Not for me, and I see 3D just fine. I know how to adjust it, and I was playing the game in 3D, and I fell off ledges all over the place, more because of the camera was so static, and some of the jumps that they had you do were... The camera is too low on the horizon sometimes to really see exactly where Mario is relative to an edge, and there were no fences or anything. I mean, you could just walk right off the edge of these stages, which I'm fine with, but it takes some getting used to, because in Galaxy, a lot of times that's not possible. He'll just walk right around to the other side. Not always, obviously, but in Galaxy, I usually felt like it was really clear where you could and could not walk over the edge, and the camera in Galaxy, because it's so dynamic, it pretty much always shows you exactly the angle that you would want. And in this game, I really felt like that straight, and you could adjust it like 30 degrees off to the left or right, but then you do that for one jump and then you get to the top and it wouldn't look right and you'd have to put it back in the middle again.
It almost feels like a 2.5D game with depth.
Yeah.
I mean,
where you actually can walk around. I suppose it's a bit like Metroid Other M in that way.
There's a bit of that, but there's no bottomless pits in Other M.
No, certainly not. Right. I mean, you just think. I mean, with Galaxy, they completely overcame the issue of not having a second analog stick to control the camera. You know, they came up with an auto camera that worked. I very, very seldom had an issue with it. And the concern I have is that if they are of the opinion that the 3D is going to be helpful to people, it might let them slack off with the camera, where, in fact, it seems that it's not that helpful and that people would like the camera to do more of the work for them, as it were. Again, it could be the kind of thing that playtesting internally could reveal some of those issues.
Well, also, I mean, they need to be careful, because if the 3D doesn't really help in any way, and this is one of the flagship titles for the handheld, I mean...
I wouldn't say that it doesn't add anything to it, though. I would say... I think the game looks cooler because of the 3D in it.
Yes.
I think the effect is very well done. I think it makes things like enemies and character models look more real. Like, they have a real structure to them, because it actually adds some depth to their model.
Makes them stand out more.
The 3D does add to this game, although I'm not sure it adds a whole lot to the gameplay. But I mean, there could be some places where it does. When they were discussing the Legend of Zelda level, they said that the 3D in that really has a good effect, because you can see the enemies jumping and it helps you determine where they're going to land.
Well, Nintendo says a lot of things.
That's the only specific example I remember them citing. But of course, that level wasn't in the demo because we all wanted to play it.
Hey, let's take a break. I think it's time that we get into actual new business. And again, we do have a lot of listener mail that I want to get to later in the show. And one of the letters addresses this whole 3D thing, so we can get back into it. But we need a break right now, so we'll be right back. Welcome back. It's time for New Business, the part of the show where we talk about video games. And Jonathan Lindemann is up first.
Yeah, well, there were three great victories this week. The Mavs won the NBA championship over the Heat. Bruins won the championship over the Canucks.
And people in Canada won over street lamps and street signs that they set on fire.
Rioted, as violent Canadians tend to do. And also my victory over Lavos Core and Chrono Trigger.
Oh, nice. John, I want to know, how long did you run that battle before you figured out which one is the real Lavos Core?
Well, not too long. Because
I think it's one of the great tricks in gaming, I think.
Oh, no. I mean, by that time, I wasn't even fucking around, and I just looked at an FAQ file. I was like, fuck this.
Oh.
Well, because the thing is that the first time I tried to do it, I went in there with Magus, Marl, and Frog. And that's cool. You can beat the first form of Lavos, where he's like the robot, and you just have to kill the two arms and then kill the middle torso head thing. And that's fine, but then the problem is that you get your ass kicked by the core because Marl, who with that particular party is your prime healer, she gets taken out like right quick, like between like probably two or three turns in, just because the core just hits really, really hard. So, I mean, what I learned was that, you know, after going online, doing some research and seeing some opinions, what I learned was pretty much everything I thought about the game was wrong. My three best characters.
In fact, it wasn't even on his DS. He was playing it on his PSP. He didn't know.
I was actually playing it on my PC, you know, whatever. So my party was, you know, Frog, Marl. They are not good. I even tried Frog, Ayla, and Robo, and that I couldn't even do that. And so, you know, effectively, one person said, I read on I think the GameFAQ forums, they said that the best party is Chrono, Ayla, and Robo. So I was like, all right, I'll try that. So what I did is, you know, the first time I went, you know, all the way to the end, I beat Black Omen because I read that you could go back and do it two more times if your characters still need experience. So I was like, okay, well, you know, I have a feeling I may have to grind up some of my characters a little bit. So, and sure enough, I did. So I went through and I did the Black Omen two more times.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's dedication.
Yeah. I was not fucking around at this point. I was like, I'm going to make sure that I go in there and, you know, have a really good shot at just clearing this whole thing out. So, yeah. So I cleared Black Omen two more times with Frog, because Frog still, I really didn't get any good text for that guy still. I mean, he had like four by the time I was done. Ayla, who I used to think was the absolute worst character, but I was completely wrong, and she is one of the best. She's pretty much the best fighter you can have. I mean, she hits so hard, and the texts that she gets are amazing, like hitting for like 3,000 points. You know, just absolutely ridiculous against any boss. And good old Robo, who I used to think was absolutely terrible, but instead he is the best healer you can possibly have.
Heal babe thing.
Yeah, heal beam is
amazing.
It heals
everyone, doesn't it?
Yep, it heals everyone. So he's also awesome too, and the great thing about him versus Marl is the fact that he can actually take a punch, and he actually hits as hard as anybody else, so he's overall the best character outside of maybe Chrono.
See, I think my favorite team is Chrono, Ayla, and Frog.
Yeah, that'd be pretty good too.
Yeah, I had
that
a lot.
Yeah.
I think that cop formed in the Giga Gaia fight, because the strike that she does with Chrono, where she goes across and takes out two things that are on the same sort of vertical position, is indispensable for taking out Giga Gaia's arms at the same time. And from then on, I just kept the team together. Like,
oh, the Falcon Strike.
Falcon Strike, yeah.
It's awesome.
Yep, so finally, I finally did beat it. But, you know, even that, I was completely on the ropes with it because I got caught into this thing where one person was dead, so the other person had to res that person, and then the other person would attack, and then the core would attack again and almost wipe everybody out. So pretty much at the very end, when I finally did beat the core, Chrono was dead. My other two characters had like 200 hit points. And so for real, one more hit and I would have been fucked. So, you know, but finally, you know, Ayla did like her cat attack. I was doing cat attack over and over again because it's like hits for like 1,000 points. And it's really cheap. It costs nothing. So I did that. Finally, like I was like, oh my god, I'm at the end of my rope, and I swear to god, if I lose one more time, I'm never playing this game again. Ayla hits, boom, done, disappears, and I'm just like, thank god, finally it's
over.
Dramatic
conclusion.
Yep, just dramatic conclusion. So after that, I rode into the sunset.
Do you feel like you will ever try New Game Plus?
I'm tempted. I'm very tempted to.
It's easier the second time through, I tell you that.
A lot
easier. It goes a lot faster, and it's a lot easier.
Yeah, because I mean, I would like to see some of the other endings. And honestly, like, I would like to try, because the thing is, like, I haven't, like I said about Frog, I mean, I don't have half the text that guy has. That's one of the cool things about the game, is the fact that you can beat it, and you still have so much stuff that you haven't filled out, you know, so many, I mean, there's a bunch of monsters that I haven't seen, there's still, you know, items I haven't seen, there's still, it's very obvious at the end of the game that there's a lot of the game that you haven't seen, so it's kind of rare among RPGs that it actually kind of pokes you to go and play it again. But yeah, I gotta say, I mean, it's an amazing game. I mean, it's really, really good. I think it's cool that you do go through, like, I mean, I did everything. I did Giant's Claw, I did Sunstone, Rainbow Shell.
Did you bring back the forest?
Yes, I did.
That's a very emotional one.
Yeah, that's a really cool one. There's stuff like that. I really like all those side quests, but I feel like if it would have been maybe guided a bit more, that could have been more effective, because I feel like at the start of that game, until you get like the epic and you can kind of move between the time periods, it's kind of slow, and you're kind of like, you know, where is this going? Like, they don't really flesh out the characters too much. It's really back heavy. So what I thought about the game at the end wasn't even close to what I thought about midway through.
That's interesting.
So, yeah, I probably would have liked it more all the way through if they would have kind of forced me into the side quests for each character and fleshed out their story kind of one by one, rather than just kind of like giving you, okay, now you can go check out whatever you want.
Well, congratulations, sir.
Thank you.
It's been a long journey.
Yes,
and,
yes.
I'm very glad for you that you've had this experience. And mm-hmm. What's next? Are you going to Disney World?
Absolutely. Actually, I'm gonna go to South Beach. I'm gonna take my game playing towels to South Beach. I'd like to announce that.
And then the choke in the finals. Right?
Nice.
Yeah.
Now, what do you think? What's your next game?
Yeah, I thought about that.
It's not something you've had to think about for a while.
Exactly. I kind of had this like 2-day hangover period where I was like, man, I don't even know what the hell I'm going to do with myself
it's
next.
It's done. It's gone.
Yeah, it's finally gone.
Is this still used to like clutch your cartridge slot, like where the wound was still aching?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm thinking maybe Dragon Quest IX. I might stay with RPGs.
Oh boy.
What?
Jesus,
John,
that for 5 years. I mean, if it took you a while to do Chrono Trigger,
that'll tide him over till the Wii U comes out.
Oh, you know, I thought about that. I did play that a little bit over the weekend.
You do have it. You've had it since pretty much since the launch of that game.
Yeah,
right?
I got it at launch.
It's an awesome game. I mean, I would love to hear your thoughts on it. It's yeah. Amazing. But geez, I mean, I played that game for like 120 hours.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm gonna do Pokemon right away. I don't know. I really don't know. See, the thing is now. Like, okay, so that's number one off of the top of the must playlist, right? Now, the other games that I haven't beaten, my top two now, probably my number one now becomes Super Mario 3. I've never played that all the
Ooh.
Way through. And I have also never played through Majora's Mask.
Ooh.
So those are the big two now. Those are the ones that kind of jump up to the top.
Now, you've played Majora's Mask.
Yeah, yeah. I owned it. Okay. And I it lost me. I was just like, this isn't nearly as interesting as Ocarina of Time. And
well, that game actually, it's almost the opposite of what you complain about in Chrono Trigger, because mm-hmm. in that game, the side quests, a lot of them are available right near the beginning.
Yeah.
And it can actually be very easy to lose the main thread of what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. The thing I always had a hard time with was just kind of figuring out, I mean, a lot of the stuff seemed very arbitrary to me, like, okay, well, you're not going to move forward in the story unless you happen to be standing by this gate at 3 a.m., and you really have no clues as to why you would want to do that. You just have some old man telling you some cryptic thing. And you're supposed to interpret that somehow into standing at a certain gate at 3 a.m.
I think you're exaggerating a little bit, but there are situations similar to that description, but they're mostly for optional side quests.
Yep.
The caffeine on you.
I do agree that sometimes the way forward can be a bit obscure. And, yeah. And the game definitely doesn't do much to push you towards the next big objective that you should do. So there's sometimes there are plenty of times I've played Majora's Mask where I spent the whole 3-day period just kind of running around trying to find something.
Mm-hmm.
Then I get a little frustrated, but you can always go back to the bomber's notebook and usually get an idea from
it. It's a very helpful plot device, the notebook. I've never particularly found myself getting lost once I've got the notebook starting to populate.
All right, well, John took his 2 weeks since the last new business to beat Chrono Trigger. Greg, what did you do?
Well, I acquired an unusual amount of games, so there was obviously the PSN welcome back thing.
Mm-hmm.
I went with Wipeout HD, which I probably would have bought eventually anyway, so that was a win for me. And then less so, Ratchet & Clank Quest for Booty, which, you know, I enjoyed crack of time. So I thought, well, you know, I wouldn't have been willing to pay for this, but for free, I'll go with that. Then, of course, there was the eShop. So to date, I've downloaded the big three virtual console-wise. So that's Super Mario Land, Link's Awakening DX, and Donkey Kong, which just came out today. Mm-hmm. And DSiWare-wise, I went with Xscape, or as it's known in Europe, 3D Space Tank.
Yes, what? It is. Yes,
really?
It is.
Yes. The eShop's launch reminded me, as if I needed reminding after the Penta Tentacles incident, the sheer clusterfuckery of the naming conventions between Europe and America with digital download stuff. It is preposterous. Like, nothing has the same name that Nintendo puts out. Nothing. PictoBits is Pico Pict.
Yep.
And Trajectile is Reflect Missile. And Starship Defense is Starship Patrol. And they're all different. And some of them are just completely different, like Xscape and yes. 3D Space Tank. so I don't understand that at all. Because if you think about it, these DSiWare games, eShop games now, they're digital, so they're much less likely to get like a lot of coverage in magazines and stuff, to the extent that people read those anymore anyway. But, you know, a lot of people, if they want reviews of those games, are going to look to online venues, which are international.
Yes.
Our site has readers from all over the Anglosphere, so to speak. And it would make sense for Nintendo to maintain name consistency so that if they see a good review of Xscape on our site, that they know that it's the same game when they're looking at the eShop now. Whereas, you know, I mean, 3D Space Tank is not terribly exciting. I don't see an awful name.
It does what it says on the tin, Greg.
Yeah, well, it's just, I don't really see that that's like worth changing it for.
So one of the pleasures I got when I did the downloads was that I would have to look up the European release date, because a lot of times the games would have come out in Europe first, because about half of the games come out of GMHBs. And what I'd always find is that there is almost no chance that I'm going to easily find the European game, because odds are it's got some whacked name that makes no sense if you have the US name from the press release. But one time I was processing the European and North American press releases because they came in the same day, and I built two different site profiles because I didn't realize they were the same game until I actually read the press release again and realized, wait, these games sound vaguely like they're the same.
I don't understand why you'd want to convolute the situation. You know, Fluidity is called Hydroventure.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, it's systematic with Nintendo stuff. I mean, I'm struggling to think of something that is called the same name.
Well, Nintendo of America and Nintendo Europe really have not done a good job of cooperating. They've been on completely different pages for the past 5 years.
It seems that way. A little bit, but anyway, I mean, so Xscape was the one. I bought £20 worth of stuff.
That's a fair bit.
What we got to remember now is that so when the Wii launched, back before the financial crisis and the pound was worth more and all that, the sort of exchange rate essentially between British Wii points and American Wii points was 0.7. So £7 would get you know, 1,000 Wii points. But I think even when they launched DSiWare, they adjusted that to 0.9. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, the eShop is inheriting the same thing. So in fact, for instance, something like Super Mario Land, which is $4 and less than an NES game, for me is £3.60, which is more than an NES game on the Wii Shop channel. So these games, you know, don't seem as good a value in that sense relative to their console counterparts now. But certainly, you know, all these ones that I got, I feel are worth the price, no doubt. So Xscape is 800 points originally, so that's $8 now. And it's by Q Games, the people who made Star Fox Command, Pixel Junk, and they're making Star Fox 64. No surprise, I suppose, from the point of view that they obviously, like Ocarina 3D Remake was sort of outsourced as well. And if you're going to outsource a Star Fox game to anyone, Q Games would probably be the people to do it.
It's barely counting as outsourcing it, to be honest.
But it's kind of funny that that is one of the, you know, relatively few Star Fox games that Dylan Cuthbert had pretty much nothing to do with.
Yeah.
That he now has something to do with.
Yeah.
But, you know, Xscape is based off one of the early prototype kind of games that he made with his involvement in Nintendo back in the early 90s for the Game Boy, which is just called X, which, mm-hmm. you know, had a very primitive but nonetheless sort of remarkable 3D environment running in sort of wireframe on the Game Boy. And that's in Japan, it's actually called X Returns, just to complete the trifecta of names. But this expands it, I guess, quite a bit. You're basically kind of going from planet to planet, fulfilling objectives, like completing little extra quests that help level up your vehicle and, you know, how powerful its attacks are, you know, how big your life bar is, that kind of thing. And when you're on each planet, there's a certain amount of different conditions. Some will have like a sandstorm will affect your visibility every now and again. On some, the gravity is more severe, so you can't actually fly on it, for instance, things like that. So they inject a certain amount of variety in it, but it does feel a little bit thin in gameplay terms. You know, they just kind of keep regurgitating some of the same core scenarios, but it's pretty satisfying overall. I mean, the aesthetic is very striking, you know, very sort of retro, a bit tronish, you know, sort of two color stark contrast kind of stuff. And the controls are a little counterintuitive at first, like, because you might think, well, you're in a tank, essentially a tank that can hover, but principally it's a tank. And so you would think, well, you can move with the D-pad and then kind of rotate it with the touchscreen or something. Well, it doesn't really quite work like that. Like, what you have to do is, you move around with the touchscreen. And then you're kind of using the D-pad as a fire button, or well, any button you can use as a fire button. And then what you can do is, if you're holding a button while you use the touchscreen, then it'll strafe. So basically you can't strafe and shoot at the same time. And that is kind of a core gameplay restriction. It's like you get into a rhythm where it's like, okay, I'm going to shoot at that enemy. Right now it's shooting at me. Strafe. Don't shoot for a while. Start shooting at it again. Move, you know, you get into a rhythm with it and it starts to feel more natural. But at first it's kind of strange. Oh, I feel like I could have more freedom of movement and shooting, but I don't. Which, you know, is a little bit of a barrier to get across. And also at first you can't just fly. You have to find these little ramps to fly.
Yeah.
But pretty early in the game you get as an upgrade, you just double tap the touchscreen and you go up in the air.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it does, that takes some of the frustration out of it, and sort of switching between being in the air and on the ground more at will, I think just freshens up the gameplay a little bit, makes it a little bit faster. And there's some nice little scenarios and some boss type encounters, and you have these little tunnel sequences between worlds where you've got very, very reminiscent of Star Fox, you know, you're avoiding like closing gates and stuff. So it's a nice package for what it is. I don't know whether it's necessarily the absolute best thing in the DSiWare catalog, but it's what I wanted to try. Certainly Shantae and all the rest of it are on the horizon fairly soon, I think.
Now, John, you have Xscape.
Yes, I do.
Because I played it at your place, and I was really frustrated by the controls.
Yeah, I thought the controls were very weird, like you said, Greg. They were kind of hard to get used to. They felt
control smash!
Yeah,
there are customizable sort of elements to it. I think you can avoid using the touchscreen for aiming or driving, or you know, you can make some adjustments there. But I went with the default scheme, worked through it for a little bit, and you know, I mean, it's not a terribly long game, so I guess any amount of time that you spend kind of getting used to it is perhaps not time that well spent. But I did get used to it, and they worked for me in the end. It felt like the game balanced out. You know, the way enemies attack you tends to be in sort of volleys. You know, so you've very much got time to stop firing, dodge, start firing again. That kind of, you know, sort of a pseudo turn based, if you like.
Yeah, I just felt like I was never getting the response out of the controls, especially turning. It just felt kind of sluggish a little bit.
That game would look really good in 3D on the 3DS.
I bet it would. Yeah,
I think it's kind of a shame that they released it really not that long before 3DS came out. I think 3DS had already been announced and shown, at least, by the time Xscape came out.
I mean, whether they could do, like, a sequel or a sort of Redux version or something, well, it kind of makes its European name all the more unfortunate, once again.
3D Space Tank 2.
This time it's really 3D Space Tank.
3D Space Tank 3D.
But, I mean, Link's Awakening, so this is a big pickup for me because, like most of the big-ticket Game Boy games from back in the day, it's something that I had touched, you know, I'd physically played it, but I'd not really played it. I'd not played through it. So my first time going through it, and, you know, it's one of the most heralded Zelda games. A lot of people would put it as one of their favorites or one of the best, so...
I put it as my favorite, actually.
So I was very eager to play this, and even though, you know, I kind of... It's something I'd always intended to go back and get the cartridge for GBA. I could put it in my Game Boy Player, but it just didn't happen. But coming to it now, I mean, I enjoyed it a lot. I mean, I talked quite a few episodes ago now about when Evan was on the show about playing through A Link to the Past and how enjoyable that was. And it's a lot of the same things apply, you know, because it is a much sort of quicker, more fluid kind of Zelda experience than the modern ones, when it's the top-down kind of way. Although it's funny how different it is from A Link to the Past in some ways. But certainly the presentation, it has a lot more charisma, it's a lot more whimsical. You know, the way that you actually have kind of a narrator that's guiding you through it, that has personality. You know, just like little things like when I unlocked a treasure chest in the dungeon, which only had some rupees in it. It was like, you've got 50 rupees. Joy! And I was like, well, I pretty much did capture my disappointment that was not the key to the door that I wanted to unlock.
It has all those side-scrolling parts, too, which I really liked.
It does have those. I
mean, they're a holdover from the original Legend of Zelda, but it's kind of an element that seemed to have been forgotten. And then they brought it back in Link's Awakening, and now it has been forgotten again. Well, it was in Four Swords Adventures, I guess.
But... I think it's also in Oracle of Seasons, I think, and Ages. I think they carried it on some. So certainly Ages, the one I played, has some little bits like that in.
It's the same engine, so that
but
makes
it's,
sense.
Yeah, it's they are very heavily leveraged on Link's Awakening, so that's no surprise, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, it has these little side-scrolling bits, and it has all these Mario sort of cameos. Goombas and all this kind of stuff. Probably the funniest Mario cameo is a very good example of the game's sort of more offbeat sense of humor than is typical for a Zelda game, where you're doing part of the big trading sequence, and you're in the animal village, and there's a goat lady that's writing a letter, and she wants you to deliver it, and so you deliver it to Mr. Wright. And you give him it, and he's like, oh, she's written back. He's really enthusiastic. And then you go, oh, she sent a picture of herself as well. And then instead of the picture of the goat lady, it's a picture of Princess Peach. It's just kind of disturbing and weird. So it's, you know, it's a very charming game, and design-wise, it does plenty of things that are very close to A Link to the Past. There's a lot of the same kinds of puzzles and little gimmicks and stuff, although it's not as intricate because in the overworld exploration, you don't have the light world, dark world thing. Or, you know, in the dungeons, most of them, I think there's one exception to this, but most of them don't have multiple floors. They're not as complex, but they're still well designed. And I certainly like the bosses, you always get like mini bosses, and then the final boss as well. I mean, there's a few that are a bit nondescript, but a lot of them make some really fun use out of the items like this, that bizarre creature, I don't know what to describe, it kind of looks like a sock puppet that throws a giant ball at you that you have to, like run to the ball and pick it up first and throw it back at it before it can, you know, throw it at you and stuff. You know, there's definitely a lot of fun, active boss encounters that help it along. So it's been a real pleasure playing this for the first time. It's always going to be difficult to rank it with Zeldas that you played very long ago. And there's a woven in, you know, with your childhood and your perception of the series. But it's definitely very good. And even though it's like the most premium virtual console title at $6, you know, it's well worth it because it's a, you know, decent sized adventure. That's for sure. It took me quite a while to do it because I'm sure a lot of people are playing it, you know, for the umpteenth time could do it a lot quicker than I did, sort of fumbling around, not knowing quite what to do. But it's going to last you a good while, and it's really good. It is as advertised. And on that note, why talk about one Zelda when you can talk about two? Because just yesterday, I got Ocarina of Time 3D. So I don't have a lot to say about it now. I will talk about it next week, presumably. But just to say that it does look very, very nice. You know, I don't know whether any of the media has really quite brought across just how much of a sort of enhancement it is over the original. I mean, it's in terms of the environment geometry, it's as angular as you'll remember it, but certainly the textures are just so kind of comprehensively overhauled that it makes a big difference. And there are some interior locations that benefit a great deal from this. For instance, the Temple of Time is completely it actually has a ceiling and walls and, you know, stuff like that. And anything that was pre-rendered before, you know, interiors or the Hyrule Castle Town, that kind of stuff, is now done with polygonal graphics. And it looks, you know, it's weird. It looks so close to those pre-rendered things, but not rubbish. You know, like it looks the same in a way, but it looks like the same place, but just like, oh, it's my cataracts are gone. You know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, it definitely looks a lot better that way. And like anything that's like on a wall, like wall signs or like the cave paintings in the Goron village.
Well, how about the forest temple with all, with those, the gallery of
I haven't got that far yet.
That's really important.
Whoa, slow him down, man.
Yeah, it's not even out yet, technically.
Come on.
I'm just saying that's the most notable place of there being a painting on the wall.
Oh, yeah, but with this, like, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, you might not have even really looked at before because it was a blurry mess, or maybe, you know, it probably wasn't even there before they've added it. You know, like, I mean, if you go into, like, Impa's house in Kakariko Village, there's all these little bits of paper around that actually have little diagrams of a lot of the way that puzzles are solved, like shooting an arrow through a torch to set something else on fire, or, you know, these little details that just, you know, with the N64, it wouldn't have even been possible. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these, like, interiors make really cool use of the 3D, because originally they had these weird camera angles because of the pre-rendered thing, but now it's like, okay, so that pot that's in the foreground or this, that, and the other, it just brings out the 3D in a really cool way. So aesthetically, it's probably a bigger upgrade than you would have got the impression of if you're just looking at, you know, the usual screenshots or whatever, which isn't to say it's stretching the system to its limits, I'm sure.
Well, Greg, we do need to move on, but I have one quick question for you. Seeing as how you have the game before it's even technically out, I assume you paid full price for it, so I'd like to know what convinced you to go ahead and buy this version of the game, because that's a topic that we've talked about a lot.
The first thing is that Nintendo were good enough to release it officially the day before my birthday, so aww, I was able to wrangle it as in that typically subtle and unassuming way of mine.
So is it your birthday now?
No, well, it's the 17th now. My birthday's the next day.
Well, happy birthday pre-birthday.
There you go.
So that was the first thing, but also, as John has put Chrono Trigger to bed now
with a bullet,
I'll raise that and say, well, you know, with Chrono Trigger, like, that wasn't something I was desperate to buy initially, you know, but then when I did end up buying it, I actually got a lot more use out of it than I thought, and I just thought, well, you know, I've really taken on a bigger appreciation for this game that I already liked a great deal and already had legendary status, just because I could play through it again in this portable format and a more smooth experience. And that's very much what I'm expecting from this, really.
So it's the portability for you.
So the portability is a big factor. The upgrade is nice. And just, you know, it is a classic that I have some desire to replay. I mean, you know, there's some things like, you know, Mario 64, I didn't have a desire to replay that on the DS. If they released a beautiful 3D version of it now, I wouldn't have a desire to replay it. But Ocarina, I would. I actually haven't replayed it since just after Wind Waker, so that's 8 years.
All right. Well, James has a surprise.
Not much of one, unfortunately. So, as I've talked about in the past, whenever we go on these trips, I always pick up a game to play on the flight. Yeah, I predictably never play it on the flight and end up playing it when I get home. But In this case, it was Lunar Knights.
Oh, yeah. I played this.
Yes, you have. And what is interesting about Lunar Knights is it's quite old now, actually.
Yeah, 2007, I want to say.
I think it's a 7. Yeah, I mean, it's quite long in the tooth at this point. And what I've found interesting about it is Lunar Knights is a GBA game. I mean, it
looks like one, mostly.
It plays like one, too. It's a very interesting study in early Nintendo DS gameplay. It kind of goes back to my conversation I had when I had Beautiful Joe Double Trouble, which is you could sort of see what we were dealing with early in the DS lifespan before we moved on and people started to just sort of deal with what we have versus what they think the DS is for. So what you have is an action... I guess you could say it's an action RPG, top-down, two characters. Well,
this is actually isometric, isn't it?
It is.
Well, it's Boktai 4 or 5.
Yeah, exactly. So if you've seen any of the Boktai games on GBA, you'll know what to expect in large measure. But, you know, I mean, point is sometimes people say something's isometric when it's just top-down, whereas this is isometric, like you're dealing in diagonals all the time.
Which it would almost be better if it were straight down, because there are many cases where you have to try to walk onto a platform and not fall off.
You can remodel the controls so that basically, like, the cardinal directions become diagonals.
Yeah, and I ended up having to do that at some point, I believe. But there's this, very early in the game, there's this moving platform you have to step on, and I probably just stepped off it a little bit because double tap makes you run.
Yes, it does.
As opposed to trying to very efficiently tap your way onto this platform, I would run off the edge of the platform and have to replay that entire screen minus 200 credits. Thank you, game. What I found is this game is actually quite primitive. In many of its design conceits are very simplistic. There's a lot of enemies, they take a lot of damage, and once you kill them, you've probably expended all your energy anyway, so you have to switch back to the Dark Swordsman. So there's two characters, there's a gunner, who shoots guns, obviously, and there's a swordsman. The guns take away your energy, the swords don't, unless you're using an elemental on them. And I found that it's very hard to keep the kid who's using the gun with level, because he runs out of energy a lot. So you end up having to use the much higher risk swordsman most of the time. And then getting to bosses where you have to use both of them in concert and realize, like, oh shit, I'm out of energy. And the only real implementation of the DS besides this sort of bizarre menu management screen that you can circumvent a bit by tapping it, Kojima Productions, just in case anybody was wondering, is this really bizarre shooter bit, like a forward-scrolling shooter, but in 3D. It's really hard to control because everything is done with a touchscreen, exclusively. The entire mode is touchscreen only, but it's basically the only time you use a touchscreen during gameplay. So you drag your ship around to avoid enemy fire. Now, you don't tap where you want it to go. You actually have to tap the ship and drag it to avoid enemy shots. Yeah. Then you have
it's like the Big Bang minigame that was released years later. It's actually quite shockingly similar.
I can see that, actually.
By the way, James, this Lunar Knights actually came out in Japan at the end of 2006.
Wow.
And it was Europe and America in February and March of 2007.
That is 2007. Really early.
To tell you how old this game
is,
Dan Bloodworth reviewed this for us. It was one of the last things he did before he left for greener pastures. So,
God, that
it is pretty old. It's more than 4 years old at this point.
So, just out of curiosity, what did Dan give this game?
8.
Oh, God, this is not an 8.
Really?
No.
I always wanted to play it. I mean, I like Boktai, so...
I quite liked it, but I hadn't played Boktai, so, you know, any improvements or regression on that would be lost on me.
I would say it was an 8 at the time, but now it just feels really dated.
Yeah, well, I couldn't imagine playing dated games, but...
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I found that later on, the whole kind of elemental... issues, you know, kind of that they came into play a bit more. You find some different weapons, like the gunner gets a lot of different styles of weapons, like shotguns and all sorts of like John Woo style double pistols. And I don't when it opened out a bit more, I got on with it better.
I'm at the so I've defeated all of the vampires at this point.
Right, yeah, that's what you're doing in those weird space shooter bits, is like banishing their bodies to the sun or something?
Oh, it's Superman 4.
Here's the completely whacked plot. The vampires were given their powers by another group called the Immortals. They were also given this thing called the Para All Caps Soul, which lets them control the environment, which means they've blocked out the sun effectively.
With a parasol.
Yeah, yes. With a giant umbrella.
Painful.
So what happens is, as you defeat these vampires, you get the ability to sort of create climates in the levels.
Yeah.
Which seems cool, but I haven't really been able to do a whole lot.
A lot of the time, it seems quite limited in terms of how much there's like specific rooms where.
Right.
Okay, so some vines will overgrow and it'll make some areas reachable or a bit of water will freeze over or stuff like that. So it doesn't seem like they hold that out for stuff that's really integral to progression.
No.
A lot of the time it's extra doodads that'll build up your character, but that's useful because, I mean, he's very much like. There are times where you just feel like, I need to be more powerful. Like, you go somewhere and you just feel like you're not getting anything done against these enemies.
The game had a very nice, smooth level progression until a level on a train, at which point it feels like the game said, yeah, you should be about 10 levels higher than you needed to be for the last level. And suddenly the game becomes this evil just feeling of, I'm not strong enough! I managed to beat through that level and then got completely stomped once the train started moving.
The thing is, there are things to find in older levels, so, you know.
Yeah, there are.
You can multitask kind of grinding with finding better equipment, and, you know, your characters will get better in both senses.
Yeah, it's a good game. I'm not sure it's one of the DS's best. I feel like there's some things on there that are just sort of anachronistic, and there's elements of gameplay that just don't really seem to fit with what the DS library has now. It would have been a great GBA game, I think. I think as a DS game, it's kind of weird, except for that shooting part, which just sucks. It sucks so bad.
Now, James, have you been playing Super Mario Land?
I haven't, because as I've noted, the eShop is not cooperating with my 3DS at the moment.
Okay. Because most of the rest of us on the E3 crew downloaded it when the eShop launched. But you were asleep, I think, that night.
I went to sleep and then I woke up and wrote.
Yeah. So I'll talk briefly about Super Mario Land because I downloaded it. I paid my $4. It is a little overpriced, honestly. This should probably be $3 like Alleyway.
Didn't TYP beat it before he hit the requisite hour to rate it?
Yep.
Yeah, well, I did that and I hadn't beaten it before. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I mentioned that I'd played it, you know, at school and never quite beaten it. And I was just with no scant familiarity with the game, let's say. I beat it, checked the timer. It's like, oh, no, wouldn't be able to review it. So.
Yeah. So what these guys are referring to is that on the eShop, you can rate games, but Nintendo requires that you've actually played it for an hour.
Or at least stared at the title screen for an hour.
Before they let you rate it, which I think is a good policy in general, but maybe there should be some flexibility when they're selling you games that can be completed in significantly less than 1 hour. Yeah, Super Mario Land is really short, and I think that's really the only knock I have against it, because I think the game is great.
It's fun. I mean, that's all I could say. It's weirdly inauthentic, you know, as a Mario game in certain ways, like the way that the Koopa shells don't bounce, they blow up.
Which makes some of the platforming very tricky when you have to kill a Koopa and you're basically forced to move to the next platform whether you're ready to or not. I think the game is challenging in some interesting ways. Some of the writing on the boulders can be a little dicey. There's, in like the next to last level, they throw these new enemies at you that look kind of like girls with ponytails, but they run around and you have to basically, they regenerate after you stomp on them. So the only way to kill them permanently is with a Super Ball, which I didn't have when I played through that level. And they regenerate after like a couple of seconds. So you really have to keep moving, or they will come back and get you. And they move in very erratic patterns. So I think the game is challenging in some nice ways. Now, if you've beaten it a bunch of times before, then that doesn't really apply to you. But if you're new, like Gregor or I, or me.
I haven't played it either.
Okay. Well, John, you can't download it because you don't have a 3DS.
I don't have a 3DS yet.
John has the ultimate eShop problem.
Well, I do think it's worth downloading. I think it is a little overpriced, but I'm not that surprised considering it's a launch title and it's a Mario game.
Yeah.
Although it's not exactly a Mario game, but it's got Mario in the title at least, so I'm not surprised that they're selling it. But I think this is absolutely the most they could get away with it. If they were trying to sell this for $5, it'd be riots in the streets because it is an insanely short game. It's 12 levels.
It's not like somebody just lost a Stanley Cup. Jesus, yeah. Johnny.
But it's four worlds with three levels each.
And a couple of those are shoot-em-up levels. So
yeah, although those are interesting. I think the submarine, or the, is it the plane at the end?
The plane at the end.
The last one, I think, is actually pretty interesting for a shooter
level. Yeah, they're interesting, but if you're wanting, you know, your typical Mario action, it's even shorter.
There's
than
10 Super Mario levels in here, which is less than 1.5 worlds in New Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, so the way the price structure seems to be is like you're probably going to have two levels for GB games and then two levels for GBC games, so you're going to run from like $3 to $6 in total, I guess.
I agree. I hope that's
I'm assuming there'll be some Game Boy Color games that won't be the $6 level, like Link's Awakening will probably be $5. Yeah. But it was weirdness with Donkey Kong, because in Japan, that's 300 yen, which is baffling, like why that would be 300 yen, considering it's God knows how many more times content rich it is than Mario Land. but then $4 in America and €4 in Europe. So
I've never played it at all, so I'm really excited to try it.
If you've played the original Mario vs. Donkey Kong before they got into the mini stuff,
which I loved,
yeah, that was based on Donkey Kong for Game Boy.
Okay, I'm getting excited now.
But a lot of people think it's the, you know, the original is better. Mm-hmm. Although, did you notice that they've kind of cut to the chase and gone straight to one game a week?
That's fine.
There's only a handful of GB games that you can push out.
It took us years to get that point in America with Wii Virtual Console, whereas like this week in Japan they had three Game Boy games. Here we got one.
So I like that they're shafting us right at the beginning, so we don't expect yeah, to be treated right. as well as Japan.
I mean, Japan is getting more than one a week. I think if they had just basically a global policy of one per week, I would be fine with that, because I think there's plenty of Game Boy games to go through, and if they could just be consistent with it and stick to high quality titles. Because the other thing is on 3DS that these virtual console releases are now competing with new DSiWare games and potentially new 3DS download games that they're going to be putting on there. So that was not the case with Wii Virtual Console in the early days. That was the only thing to download. I think it made more sense to release multiple games at a time back then.
That was a time where things happened, and now we're not in that time anymore.
Those were the good old days.
The only time we get multiple virtual console Wii games is when Capcom's shitting out some more old arcade titles. Mm-hmm. It's like, who wants Black Tiger? No one raises their hand.
Well, I give big props to Capcom for they're keeping Virtual Console alive on Wii. They just put out Mega Man 5, which is a good game, but I'm waiting for 6 with a jetpack. That's the only, other than 2 and 3, that's the only other NES Mega Man that I'd really be interested in downloading. And, you know, they did Mega Man X recently, and I hope they'll continue with that series as well. And I'm still holding out for Demon's Crest, which a couple years ago I thought was pretty hopeless. At this point, it looks like it's feasible. So
yeah, and Gargoyle's Quest for Game Boy is got to be a possibility as well.
I hope
it?
So. That's a really good game too.
Because they've already had the Game Boy Mega Man come out in Japan, so Capcom are on board, obviously.
So, just to get back to Super Mario Land, it is really fun. It is extremely short, but it's totally a game that I will play through again at some point. It's short enough that you can actually beat it in one sitting, which actually makes it more likely that I'll go back and play it again sometime when I've got 30, 45 minutes to kill and I feel like accomplishing something. And also, I think the game's worth just turning on just to listen to the music.
These
hip Tanaka songs in this game are fabulous. They're awesome. Some of them are almost intentionally annoying, like when the time starts to run out, the music goes about 4 times faster than it was before, and it's almost unlistenable, and I love that.
Another weird sort of on the Mario touch is the can-can for the invincibility. Like, instead of the classic theme tune, you get the old bum 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 bum.
That's funny.
It really does feel like what it is, a Mario game not made by the usual makers of Mario games.
Yeah. It's made by Gunpei Yokoi.
Yeah, and Hip Tanaka, of course, who did the music for the original Metroid, it was all those people.
I think he did the Metroid 2 soundtrack as well, which is, as we talked about, the probably one of the weirdest game soundtracks ever made. Certainly one of the weirdest for Game Boy. And, you know, maybe you can hear some of the roots of that in Mario Land, just in he's clearly messing around with the Game Boy sound chip and trying to see what he can get out of it. And it's a lot of fun to listen to. Very, very, very catchy tunes. And they're really fun. And they don't sound like Mario music. They sound like something different, which is fits in with the rest of the game, that's for sure. So I also downloaded a DSi. I've downloaded a few DSiWare games, and some of them I literally haven't touched. Like Shantae, haven't turned it on. I unwrapped it on the menu, and that's it. And I downloaded Link's Awakening, same thing. So I've got a few things that I need to catch up on, and I just haven't had time. Because, it's like Greg said. I mean, I in the course of about a week, I own about 10 new games between PlayStation Welcome Back and the eShop opening. So I've got a hell of a backlog that I'm working through. And I did, for anyone wondering, I did actually buy a game with my 3DS. I got Ridge Racer, and it's really good. And I...
Ridge Racer!
They don't say it quite that way, but...
No, they don't, but it's 15 eyes, by the way, in case anybody's wondering.
Officially.
Even Jack Tretton's getting in on that joke now.
Yeah.
That
was awesome.
That's how much of a meme it is.
Well, Ridge Racer's a big game. As James has mentioned, there's a lot to do in it, and I have barely scratched the surface, so I'm playing it, but I'm going to talk about that next week, probably. So I wanted to bring up Alpha Bounce, because this seemed like one of the more accessible pick-up-and-play DSiWare games in the bunch that I bought. And it's a game that I had been lusting after ever since it originally came out, and Neil wrote about it and talked about it a lot. This is the Arkanoid RPG. And the value of that is that it's $4. It's ridiculous value because it's got hundreds of levels. I mean, I think they're possibly randomly generated. I'm not sure, but they follow different themes and they get more complicated as you go on. They get more challenging. And, it actually, in terms of the gameplay, it reminds me more of Arkanoid 2, The Revenge of Doe, D-O-H. Mm-hmm. Like the Homer Simpson joke. I know.
Without the apostrophe, presumably.
Yeah. Doe, apparently they assumed that all Arkanoid fans knew that Doe was the final boss in the original Arkanoid. The problem there is no one's actually beaten the original Arkanoid.
I'm not sure the original Arkanoid has an ending. It may just be rumored.
It has about 100 levels, and I think I've only ever seen... There was a code that let you skip forward by a certain increment. Like, you could skip forward every 12 levels or something like that. So I've seen a lot of the later levels, but not necessarily all the ones in between them. But that game is absurdly difficult. I love Arkanoid. I love it, especially for the music. But anyway, The Revenge of Doe was the sequel, and I had it on computer for some reason. I think I had some kind of pirate copy that somebody gave me. I don't even remember how I got it. But I played a lot of it on my PC back in high school years. And The Revenge of Doe was actually in some ways a lot easier than the original Arkanoid because it had so many more power-ups, and some of them were really powerful. So instead of creating 2 or 3 balls at a time, it would create about 20, and they would just obliterate the blocks on the top of the screen. Or you could get a lead ball that literally wouldn't bounce off the blocks. It would just blast through the bricks and would only bounce off the top of the screen, basically. So it had all these different power-ups that made the game a lot more manageable. And Alpha Bounce has all of that stuff, plus a bunch of more that they invented. And unlike The Revenge of Doe, you can stack them. So the crazy thing about Alpha Bounce is that a lot of times the levels will start out really slow. It's just your balls bouncing up and down, up and down, and it's breaking one brick at a time, and it's really slow. And then you get a power-up, and the power-up helps you break bricks a little bit faster. And then about 5 power-ups will come down at the same time, and you can collect all of them, and they're all active at the same time. And then you have about 30 balls zigzagging in a drunken manner, swirling into a vortex in the middle of the screen as the level cracks apart like the Red Sea in the Bible, and lasers are spraying out of your ship at the bottom of the screen. I mean, the screen just like blows up at some point. Like, there's a critical mass of power-ups that you inevitably hit if you're going to beat the level, and at that point, you don't even know what's going on, and it's a challenge to even am I still supposed to hit a ball here? Like, I don't know what's going on. Things are flying everywhere. There's aliens. There's ships are flying across the screen. I turned a row into jello. It's completely batshit crazy, and it's really fun. But every level ends that way. And I guess that would be my problem. It would be a lot more amusing if that was like a weird freak thing that happened with a certain lucky alchemy of power-ups. Instead, that's pretty much how every single level ends, because at some point you will get so many power-ups that shit just implodes and the level ends.
Story of my life.
Yeah, yeah. But it is a really fun game. I think it certainly has the risk of being repetitive, especially given just how much content is in there and how every stage does seem to kind of end in this catastrophe of power-ups. But it's very flashy, and it's really neat. And it does have this kind of weird RPG metagame where you're traveling around on a grid through the galaxy, and if you get to certain levels and you beat them, then you get some kind of power-up for your ball or for your paddle, which those seem really insignificant compared to the power-ups that you get in the levels, but maybe eventually you get some that are actually really useful. I don't know. But it's a neat game, and I think for $4, it will keep you playing for a very long time. So if you like Breakout, Arkanoid, Shatter, etc., if you like brick-breaking games, then Alpha Bounce seems like a pretty solid purchase.
If you like brick-breaking games, basically WiiWare and DSiWare is like the best thing that's ever happened in your life. Because there's so much brick breaking on those services, like, it's dangerous to have it in a house.
Yeah, there's Brick Breaker Deluxe, and there's Block Breaker Deluxe.
There's Breaking Blocks. Everybody on the street, Breaking Blocks.
Yeah, there's plenty to choose from. The reason I was attracted to Alpha Bounce is it's clearly going for something kind of a little bit different than all the rest of them, and I think it achieves that. I don't know that it's entirely successful as a genre mixing experiment, but it's definitely fun, and it's cheap again, so that helps a lot. So the last thing I wanted to talk about is Vanquish, which is the Platinum Games title. One of you guys played it last year. Who was it?
I had played the demo.
The demo.
That's all I played of it.
Sure. I remember it had been brought up, and I had played the demo too, and I really liked that. So I rented it on Gamefly, and I love this game. I really do. I've been playing through it slowly because I actually got it before E3, and I've been really pressed for time this week, so I've been playing it just kind of like an hour here, an hour there. But it's totally Gears of War from a Japanese perspective, and I think it's really better for that. I think it brings a lot to that third-person cover-based shooter that makes it more fun, more accessible, a lot faster paced, and just crazier and more enjoyable than something like Gears of War. And I've really, really enjoyed it. I mean, it's completely over the top. It is bro-y in its own way. The story is completely ludicrous. I mean, it starts out with this future Russian guy microwaving San Francisco from the moon.
Yeah.
And so you go to the moon to stop him from microwaving New York City. So it's totally ridiculous, but I love the art aesthetic, which is almost the total opposite of Gears of War, because everything's white and silver instead of brown and gray. And it's really fast-paced because you've got this, like, rocket slide that you do all over the map, and you can also, like, roll and go into slow motion in order to attack enemies. It's a fairly easy game, well, I guess, to be fair, I have it set to easy because that's what everybody had said was the best way to play it.
That will make it easy.
But the game's really fun. It has this kind of interesting upgrade mechanic where you have 3 weapon slots, and there's probably 10 weapons in the game, and it's constantly giving you, you know, dropping various weapons for you to switch and to refill your ammo and such. But if you keep a weapon the same and you keep refilling it with ammo but not overriding it with a new weapon, then every time you get ammo for it, it will add like a little star symbol to it. And if you get enough of those, it will actually upgrade the weapon. So it'll increase your ammo capacity or increase the damage that it does. And so what it encourages you to do is, like, find the weapons that you really like and then stick with them and be loyal to them, and then they will become insanely powerful. There's almost a danger of accidentally picking up a new weapon and overriding the one that you've worked so hard to upgrade, because the game's so fast-paced and there's so many weapon drops that I actually have to be really careful that I don't accidentally pick up the wrong one. But it's really fun, for sure. So one last thing I wanted to mention before we wrap up this segment is that, you know, we got to do all the street passing at E3. I got almost 500 street passes.
Yeah, it was
that
crazy.
Week.
I think that's like, probably more than I'll get in my lifetime.
It was like a bacchanalia of street pass.
I became really addicted to it, and I anticipated that I would be really let down when I came home to Colorado and found that I got none. And sure enough, I haven't really gotten any natural street passes. I haven't been out and about that much, but I do live on a route on which a lot of college students go to school on. And so I was kind of hoping that if I left it near the window, you know, that it might be close enough to the sidewalk outside that some people might actually walk by with their 3DSs.
They might be walking too fast.
He's just giving me an idea for a new police song, Roxanne, don't turn off the street pass.
You know, and I think proximity-wise, it should work. The problem is nobody's walking with their street passes. That's the problem. But maybe as adoption increases and more people learn the glory of Street Pass, maybe in the future this would actually work. But I did get a couple Street Passes this week. So this was a little bit forced maybe, but someone invited me to go see Scott Pilgrim versus the World at Red Rocks Amphitheater. And I've been to concerts there, but I've never seen a movie there. And I kind of wanted to try that out because that is a popular thing to do in the summer, is to go to film at the Rocks. And I don't get to go to Red Rocks often enough for my taste. It's an awesome place. It's an outdoor venue and one of the most beautiful in the country. So I thought, hey, that sounds really fun. Even though I'd already seen Scott Pilgrim, I didn't mind seeing it again. Obviously, it's a movie that really all video game fans should see, I think. I had forgotten how much Legend of Zelda music is in the movie. A lot of stuff from Link to the Past, sound effects even. A lot of stuff from Mario, Final Fantasy, of course. So it is a gamer's movie for sure, and I thought, well, if I'm going to get a street pass, this is the place. So yes, I took my 3DS to Red Rocks and walked around a little bit. You know, I had to get up and go get beers anyway. So I did manage to pick up two street passes at Scott Pilgrim versus the World, and that was pretty exciting actually. And I was showing my friends; they didn't even know what that was, but I was, you know, hey, look, I got a street pass. So it is oddly enough, when you're walking around with your 3DS and you take it out of your pocket and you see that little light has turned green, it clicks with something in your brain, and it just makes you smile, and you think, yes, I did it. And you don't know who it is. I mean, it may not. I think there's actually an intentional delay on that indicator light so that you won't know exactly when you street pass with someone, which is a safety thing, I think. But it's such a wonderful feeling to know that you actually made it work. And I got really blasé about it at E3 because it's like, man, I got to keep pulling this thing out to clear out the queue so I can get 10 more.
It was literally a chore.
It was a chore. It really was.
It was a chore you had to do every 3 minutes, though.
At one point, I was live blogging a developer roundtable and clearing out my street pass queue at the same time.
Well, because we wanted to get all the Koizumi creepy Mies.
It was almost a chore at E3, although I did enjoy doing it every day. But I think in the natural situation, in the natural environment of street pass, it is a wonderful surprise to see that the little light has come on and that you've connected with someone, even though they might be long gone by the time you see it. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that and also remind everyone to go see Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
And the next time they release a film with a huge amount of video game references, take your 3DS to it.
Obviously, yeah.
Well, I think after the success of Scott Pilgrim versus the World, there probably won't be that movie for a little while.
Well, there were 5,000 people at Red Rocks to watch this movie, so that's about that's about as many tickets as they sold over the entire U.S. theatrical run last year.
Pretty much. I was going to make that joke, but you beat me to it.
No, I was really shocked at how many people showed up. And people, it must have some kind of cult status developing because people were, you know, like cheering at certain moments of the film. It seemed like a lot of people there were very familiar with it. All right, well, that's going to wrap up new business this week. Now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Did you hear about Final Fantasy, BitTrip on a Disc, Retro Studios' current project, or the new Professor Layton? Even if you check the site every day, you probably missed a few things. Carly puts together an article called E3 2011 Highlights, and you can find it in our news section. And also with our E3 Video Roundup Ultimate Edition. Jared destroyed E3 with his video coverage, and now you can find every single one of those clips embedded in a single article. Not recommended on the 3DS browser. The easiest way to find Jared's roundup is the feature article image on our front page.
We begin our lineup of reviews this week with LEGO Pirates of the Caribbean, the video game. Danny and Pedro tag team this Wii game from opposite sides of the world. And Pedro might know a little something about the Caribbean, because of course he's a pirate. Next we have the Wii Super NES Classic Controller. Nick reviews this Club Nintendo reward, available to fortunate fans in Australia and Europe and Japan and several other places not called America. It's a Super Nintendo controller for your Wii.
That's what I heard.
Next we have the inevitable review of Dead or Alive Dimensions from Zach, who shrugged off brain surgery to go ahead and focus on things that make Dead or Alive important. Boobs. We also have a feature of the unfortunately named Top 10 Game Boy Advance Games. For the 10th anniversary of the GBA launch, we've polled the staff and come up with our list of favorite titles for the handheld.
So finally, we've got a feature on 10 years of reviews at Nintendo World Report. When GBA launched in 2001, so did our first game and hardware reviews. Neil put together this brief look at some of the most notable reviews from the past decade, including the first one ever, Billy's review for Super Mario Advance, and every 10 scored review ever given on the site, with interesting stats, trivia, and links to all of the above. And we also have an editorial from Nathan Mustafa on why handhelds aren't dead. Nathan explains why you shouldn't believe gamers and writers who claim that 3DS and Vita can't compete with smartphones and tablets. Also, our news team is blowing up the internet with daily reports that are being cited by the likes of Gamasutra, Edge, etc. You can read it all first at NWR. Welcome back, everyone, for our favorite part of the show. It's listener mail time. The email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We try to get some of your letters on every week, and we had a mountain of great emails through E3, and we had a number of compliments on our podcast coverage of the show, and so I thank you very much, everybody who wrote in about that. I'm glad you liked it. We had some, we had a number of questions about the stuff from E3 that, I thought could, be answered pretty quickly. So I actually want to lead off with a few, quick hits here, things that we can answer pretty straightforwardly, and then we'll get into some of the usual discussion type questions after that. So first off, Buttle writes, I'm curious how the Wii U controller's A, B, X, Y buttons feel compared to the classic controller or the DS. They looked a little small.
They felt like buttons. I didn't really notice that they felt any differently than the classic controller.
I think they were a little bit smaller than the classic controller, but not as small as the ones on a DS.
And they weren't the squishy buttons either. They were just buttons.
They didn't stand out in any way.
No, I didn't make any kind of mental note of them. Let's put them that way.
I can tell you the shoulder buttons, the L and R and ZL and ZR.
The ZL and ZR are just lost.
They're in a bad place. I think we'll have another email about that, but they're definitely in a bad place. But I can tell you all four of those shoulder buttons are just buttons. There's no pushiness to them. There's no squishy analog trigger type thing.
No, this isn't the GameCube controller.
Right. All right. So the next quick hit is from Jason, and he writes, the Wii U controller doesn't allow you to use the D-pad and ABXY buttons comfortably with the L and R buttons on top of the controller. You'd only have easy access to the ZL and ZR buttons, just two of the four shoulder buttons. What does this mean for multi-platform games?
I don't think you have access to those buttons even if you aren't using those other four face buttons. I think they're sort of like out there on their own, kind of like the Z button on the GameCube controller.
Yeah, I think Jason has it backwards. I think the ones that you can easily access on the on that ridge are L and R.
Yes.
So ZL and ZR are placed on the very top corners of the controller, and they really are hard to reach. Very much like the Z button on GameCube, as James says.
And my impressions of the controller, which are like measurement based and garbage, they really are. I concluded they're basically menu buttons, which is what Nintendo said the Z button was intended for.
And it was never really used for a menu.
Yeah, it really wasn't.
It was on the Game Boy Player.
It was. Yeah, I'm not sure they're particularly useful, but remember, we have a touchscreen. You can always map buttons to that.
Right. That's the saving grace. And the touchscreen is very much within reach of your thumbs from the standard controls. So that's not an issue at all. I think there's plenty of room on there for you to have soft buttons. And for a lot of games, that makes perfect sense. But, I mean, the whole thing about other controllers is that I guess everybody has a different style to it, but I certainly don't hold other controllers in such a way that I can hit both of the shoulder buttons at the same time.
Yeah, I don't either.
So I like on a PS3 controller, I can't push L1 and L2 at the same time. I mean, you could hold it with two fingers up there, but I don't find that very comfortable, so I would only ever use one or the other at any given time.
I think he's saying that if you've got your thumbs on the face buttons, you won't be able to even reach the Z buttons.
That depends on the shape of your hand, but I think for most people that's true.
I've got big hands, baby.
It's really out of the way. Those are bad buttons. They're just in a bad place, and I think Nintendo needs to consider moving those elsewhere on the controller.
I'm not sure where you'd put them, though, except put them under the unit, at which point they could bump against your hands while you're playing.
How about under the ridge, on the other side of the ridge?
I mean, we talked about you could map certain things to the touchscreen or whatever, and then, of course, because it supports the Wii peripherals, I mean, you know, if it's a multi-platform game, it may well have the option to see if you plug your classic controller into a Wii remote, you can just play it as if you were playing it on the PS3 or the 360, which, you know, would take away some of the unique functionality, if it has any, of playing it on the new controller, but maybe that'll have its own workarounds with the touchscreen, so you'd have the choice.
Well, and to continue that point, they have shown the controller, unnamed, be held both book-wise and just sort of column-wise. So if you're holding it 90 degrees from where they usually showed it, those buttons on the side could be used for things like scrolling.
Oh, yeah.
I could totally see them doing something like, not an e-book, because, God, we don't need an e-book reader on there. But but on ebook readers,
you get 100 classic books, I'm sure.
A lot of ebook readers have a scroll button on the side, an up down scroll, and they could use it for stuff like that.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. I don't think that controller will be used book format very much, but it's neat that you can do that, because you can't really do that anymore on 3DS. Not really, because the 3D screen won't work at all in that format.
It'll make you dizzy looking at it sideways. Actually, it's kind of disorienting.
Well, if you turn the 3D off, then you can use it for other things. But yeah, I think James and I both agree from having played it that the ZL and ZR buttons suck and should be moved and should not be relied upon by developers.
I'm okay with where they are, but I don't think anybody's going to use them for much.
Yeah. Which does mean that the controller is down a couple buttons from comparable controllers.
But it also has a touchscreen.
You know, I think it'll be okay. The other thing is it's already down because it doesn't have clicky sticks.
Yeah, that was my next question.
No, I tried.
No clicky sticks.
Another quick hit. Mr. Mals writes, my friends all pronounce the word D-E-K-U from Zelda Ocarina of Time as Dooku.
Wrong.
While I say Deku.
Correct.
Do you guys know the correct pronunciation, though I realize there may not be a correct pronunciation for an English translation of a Japanese game?
It's Deku.
And how do you pronounce it?
Dooku if it was a Star Wars character.
Yeah, exactly. Did the great Deku tree just remind them of Christopher Lee? Is that why we got to this point?
I think that's the connection we're making
here,
right?
That could happen.
But, I mean, it's obviously no voice acting in Zelda, so I've never really thought about it.
Deku.
Too much, but I've always thought Deku, but...
To put perspective, I've seen it in katakana as Deku.
Well, there you go.
So that's the Japanese pronunciation, so if you want to assume that it's the same in English...
Which is pretty safe, generally speaking.
Usually.
I mean, if they're just making up words, let's make up a different word for English. Fuck it, let's go.
Darku?
Dark.
That's what I'm saying from now on.
Just any vowel you want to put in there.
By that argument, it would be The Legend of Zelda.
The Legend of Zelda? I mean,
nice.
I always said Deku.
Deku, I could see that. The little voice in my head when I'm reading doesn't say that, but uh-huh. I could understand Dooku. I'm mystified.
Well, our final quick hit for this episode is Tales of Fan writes, for the Zelda 25th anniversary, I'm really hoping at the least that Nintendo includes a Zelda-themed track in Mario Kart 3DS, and at the most, Link playable in his Wind Waker form. Do you think this is plausible or merely wishful thinking on my part? Well, it's interesting. I don't think that Link would be a playable character, because they've never done any kind of... They don't really go outside of the Mario universe for these games.
The Mario Kart arcade game.
With Pac-Man.
Yeah.
That arcade thing's very separate. Yeah.
Well, it still counts. I'm still counting it.
It's worth mentioning. I mean, the other thing that's worth mentioning, of course, is the level in Super Mario 3DS.
That's where I was going.
Zelda level, so that's one crossover. And, of course, we talked about Link's Awakening having the Mario references in it. So, I mean, there has been... sort of this this cross-referencing that's happened before. Whether Mario Kart's really the venue for it, I'm not sure. I mean, sometimes in a Mario Kart game, I'm struck by the fact I wish it would reference Mario more, rather than just like, oh, a farm.
Yeah, exactly.
Why is the ground covered in... Oh, that's chocolate? Really?
It's not exactly Smash Brothers when it comes to the beautifully studied fan service and, you know, like, so to kind of graduate it up to, you know, another series, it's probably not going to happen. But it'd be a nice touch.
It could, and I think, you know, with the anniversary and with the fact that they're already doing it in Super Mario 3DS, and also, I think there are tons of interesting locations in Zelda that you could draw from, and quite frankly, we're never going to get a Zelda kart racer. So it would be kind of nice to see at least one of the recognizable Zelda locations turned into a Mario Kart track. I think that would work much better than putting Link in a go-kart.
Well, instead of a farm, you could just have Lon Lon Ranch, you know.
Yeah. Lon Lon Ranch, Death Mountain, you could do that.
Yeah.
So I just... somewhat tangentially related to the previous line of conversation. I didn't realize in GP2 they added a Tamagotchi. Holy fuck.
Natural fit.
Yeah. So, apparently nothing is sacred.
Wait, there's a Mario Kart GP2?
Yes.
Yeah?
They made a second one?
Yes.
Wow.
I had no idea.
Yeah, that's pretty obscure.
Well, so now we're going to get into the meteor questions, and John has the first one.
All right, well, we touched on this a little bit earlier, but Shy Guy writes, what kind of dual sticks does the Wii U controller use? Neil's impression, our own Neil Ronahan, said, quote, the two analog sticks are circle pads that are similar to the one on the DS. And then he refers to Nathan Mustafa. He says, his impression said, quote, the analog sticks are responsive and set within a conical cavity in order to replicate the feel of a traditional joystick without protruding too far from the controller face. Which is it? Are the analog controls good enough to get a high score in something like Geometry Wars?
No.
What about my awesome impressions? God.
Neil's correct on this one. They are circle pads.
Well, they're not exactly the same, though.
No, they're not exactly.
They're a little bit taller than the circle pads.
Well, mechanically, the way that they're...
They're circle pads, yeah.
Yeah, the way that they move... is the same way as circle pad. The actual nub that comes up off the controller is shaped differently. It's taller, and it has this ridge around the outside that I hate.
I didn't really notice that much, but why they did this is pretty straightforward. It's a grip thing, but it also lets you slide your thumbs off of it to the buttons very easily, whereas if there was height to the sticks, you wouldn't be able to slide them off, and your fingers would be stretched away from the inner part of the screen, meaning that you wouldn't be able to support the weight so evenly.
So the tips of your thumbs kind of sit down in the circle pads.
Well, because they're not full sticks, they're much shorter.
Yeah.
Which means your hands can wrap further inside of the controller because your thumbs don't have to go out so far.
Yeah.
It's interesting that they went this approach because, I mean, in theory, they could have made just short control sticks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I understand why they're short.
The Vita has short joysticks.
Right.
Which I've heard good things about those.
Maybe they felt like it just you'd have to recess them too far to get the maximum tiltability out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Which you would, because the head of it would cause it to impact the sides.
And also, I mean, you do wonder, you know, it's an interesting contrast that we've got now where we began with the Wii Remote, you know, and this, where we basically want to make it look as little like a game controller as possible.
Right.
So they didn't have an analog stick on that at all. They just had a D-pad and, you know, the sort of remote became NES style when you tilted it on its side, but it was supposed to look unintimidating.
Right.
So now you've got this, which is an all-you-can-eat buffet of interface. It's got sticks, it's got gyro, it's got touchscreen, it's got a stylus in the back.
It's got a camera.
The funniest thing about that presentation...
It's got a microphone. I mean, it's fucking everywhere.
If you saw the press conference by Nintendo, the slide where they start listing off the features of the controller, they run out of room on the slide.
It's the best slide I've ever seen in a Nintendo press conference.
It's too much. We can't tell you.
That was one of the about 74 times I almost busted out laughing during that press conference.
not when Miyamoto was about to get shot by the hilarious Zappa attachment. That was the moment where I thought, this is like a trolling mock-up where we've got a Zapper, but with the Wii U controller set in this huge...
That was when I actually did lose it in the middle of the press conference.
That was hilarious.
I think I might have said, oh my god, that's the worst thing I've ever seen.
And then someone sniping Miyamoto while he's changing his trousers
okay,
or something.
But here's the interesting thing about the Wii U Zapper. It's actually a lot more functional than the Wii Zapper, because if you look at those, if you freeze frame that video, they're actually playing with a nunchuck that's connected to the Wii U controller. Because the if you did that same configuration without the Zapper, you'd be holding the Wii U controller in one hand in this kind of awkward... It's too big to really hold in one hand in that way. So you're giving it some support structure. So it's actually, I think, a lot more ergonomic to play with that kind of Zapper.
It still looks utterly unusable.
It just looks very funny.
It looks crazy. But it's actually, I think, got
it's
some...
It's insane.
It has some utility to it, whereas the Wii Zapper takes a controller that's already made to be held that way and actually makes it less comfortable to hold.
No, I mean, that is the just role-play kind of stuff to some extent with the Wii, whereas this might have some utility. But the point I was going to make was that I think just the visuals is part of it, that a circle pad type, less obviously like a typical gaming joystick, is something they want, so that those elements of the controller that are more like a traditional gamepad could kind of fade into the wallpaper a little bit for people who might just want to look at it as a touchscreen for some of these, you know, casual type games that they're going to make for it. So, you know, it's a sort of aesthetic design challenge of, we've got something here that's got everything and more that all those game controllers that we said were too complicated have. And how do we make that look unintimidating? And I think these circle pads are part of that.
So I can't recall. Is there any tilt at all on these circle pads?
No.
Yeah, I felt.
And that's my problem with circle pads. I mean, I have to say, I'm not really sold on the 3DS circle pad. I know a lot of people like it, and I think it makes sense for a handheld because it has to fold flat. You know?
Yeah, the form factor.
I think it makes less sense on a console controller, and I don't think it feels as good as a real joystick. And on the 3DS, you're not going to get a real joystick anyway. There's nowhere to put it.
I am concerned, to say the least.
On the new controller, I think they would be better off putting... I mean, the nunchuck joystick is great. The classic controller joysticks are great. Go with those, please, because... I did not think that the circle pads on the Wii U controller I don't think they felt that great. I think the little ridge around the edge feels horrible. And also and it's completely smooth on the inside. So your thumb actually slides around significantly within the outer perimeter of the
circle
pad.
That's why they call it the slide pad. Oh!
Yeah, it's
why
really,
they used to call it that.
It's not good. It's not good, man. I was actually almost moving my thumb so that the really, like, thick, fat part in the center of my thumb was over the center of the circle pads, because then I could basically push down in such a way that it wouldn't slide. Because if I use the tip of my thumb, which is what I prefer, it actually would slide around. It needs some ridges. It needs those concentric rings that you have on the nunchuck joystick.
See, maybe that's why I'm not so bothered by it, because that's the part of the thumb I use on a control stick. Mm. So for me, they're not being ridges there. It's actually more comfortable.
Yeah.
I didn't. I mean, the N64 ones were too much. They just.
Yeah, they ate hands. I mean.
Yeah.
GameCube was better, but I like the nunchuck, which is more sparse in that sense. You know, it's enough. But I mean, obviously, again, you know, if we're talking about Geometry Wars, you can plug in a classic controller and do it that way, but it's going to be a sort of weird trade-off that, you know, it's almost a bit like 3D, like, well, it's nice with it on, but the frame rate's better with it off. You know, it could get into that kind of territory where, you know, it's like, well, there's certain nice things about using the new controller, but in terms of good old-fashioned practicality, yeah, it's better to have the classic controller. I mean, at least you will have the choice, but...
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah,
That's from game to game, so we can't guarantee that you'll have the choice.
Yeah, well, DKC Returns says
hi. It's just a trade-off that it's not necessary. I don't think circle pads are the right choice for this controller.
I don't like
circle pads aren't that great to begin with, and I'll tell you why. Because the slide pad, the original name slide pad that they used for 3DS last year, was actually much more descriptive about how this thing actually works, because you're sliding it against the face of a flat surface, which is not a natural motion for your thumb in the way that your hands arch around this thing that you're holding. And the nice thing about a thumbstick, which the N64 pioneered, of course, is that it is on a lever arm, and so your thumb is moving around in a 3D space as you move the character. And it makes more sense for controlling a 3D character on a screen, but it also is more ergonomic. It's more the way that your thumb naturally wants to move. Your thumb isn't designed to move on a 2D plane. And I've had this problem even playing 3DS games already, is that my thumb really doesn't fit the motion that the circle pad enforces. And I think putting that on a console controller removes the necessity that it has on the 3DS, and I really don't understand why they would go with this unless they just feel like this is the new thing that they do.
Well, that's why I raised the sort of aesthetic issue to some extent. It's just that they want it to be as not, you know, unobtrusive as possible, which is would be a kind of a lousy reason, I think, to do it that way. But I mean, I think it's in play because, I mean, I do think they care about that sort of thing. They don't want it to look too, it's got to be like a secret game controller, you know.
Well, maybe they just want to set it apart from the nunchuck.
I kind of want to play a game with it because we didn't really have any game experiences with this thing.
Not much. Well, like in New Super Mario Brothers, you actually had to use the D-pad. It wouldn't let you use the circle pads to control it, which is telling, quite frankly.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe that's... I don't know what the hell they're doing. Honestly, I just want to try a game with the circle pads.
Yeah, I question how a first-person shooter would control with the circle pads.
Well, I played Ghost Recon Online with it, and I can tell you it didn't feel that great.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure you can judge anything from that demo because it lasts all of 18 seconds. I mean, it's the Golden Sun DS demo all over again.
That's not true. But
it is an incredibly short demo in which you shoot at one robot that walks around and does not much in particular.
Look, I think the Wii U controller already has this big, crazy ridge on the back of it, and the space above that on the back is not used at all. It's not in the way of anything. I really think Nintendo should consider using a recessed thumbstick instead of that circle pad, because they can easily put a hump, on like a dome, on the back of the controller to give it that volume so that you can recess the thumbstick, and it wouldn't have to stick up above the face any more than the circle pads already do, and I think it would feel a lot better. But okay, so Greg has the next email.
This one is from Ninsage, and he writes, I'm a few hours into Monster Tail, and I'm loving it so far. I can't fully recall Johnny's reaction to the game. I seem to remember he was gushing over several aspects but was turned off by the backtracking, which I'm already finding noticeably poor. In any case, given current events, I can't help but imagine the possibilities of this franchise on the Wii U. The controller would allow for excellent platforming and a more interactive Monster Home on the lower screen. From a business standpoint, it seems that high sales usually, but not always, guarantee a sequel. Yet low sales don't discourage sequels as much as one might think. I don't think Monster Tail has sold very well at all, it may even have flopped, but given its Wii U potential, do you think we'll ever see a sequel come to that platform? Or is even a 3DS sequel a pipe dream? Thanks very much, and please continue leaving all other gaming media in your pixelated dust.
All right, well, thanks, Ninsage. You remembered my reaction correctly. I really like Monster Tail. I think it has a lot of wonderful qualities, and I was lamenting the fact that the Metroid-y aspect of it isn't really done that well.
And then the character's slow.
The character is too slow, yeah. that Metroid kind of game doesn't work well with slow characters, which is why we were saying a couple weeks ago that it wouldn't work with Donkey Kong, because he's just too slow.
Yeah, I haven't been able to play it because it doesn't look like it's ever coming to Europe. I might import eventually, but, you know, opportunities have to present themselves with that sort of thing. But, I mean, Dream Rift, as they are now, you know, the people that left EA after they did Hatsworth, have shown, you know, a willingness to kind of grapple with two-screen game design in excess even of that of Nintendo. Yeah. Really. So it is natural to think about them doing something on Wii U, you know, which is a slightly different kind of two-screen gaming, but I just can't imagine the production values would kind of comport with a HD console game at this point. Unless
it could be for Wii U-ware.
Yeah, digital. Yeah. So
WooWare?
WooWare.
Wii U.
A downloadable game is something that you could consider. Certainly, you know, it'd be nice if we got to the point where, you know, downloadable software on the eShop, you know, original games, occupied a nice sort of middle ground where somebody like Dream Rift could make a product that might struggle at retail, but they can sell it at a fair price on the eShop that would be enough to cover their investment in it in the first place, and it could be a success. I mean, maybe Shantae is the blueprint for that. Obviously, we don't know how successful that's been, but it could, you know, they could perhaps fill that kind of space with the 3DS in the future.
Yeah, I think if you look at the art style of Hatsworth and Monster Tail, the 3DS doesn't seem like the most natural next step for them, because I think the kinds of games that they've made wouldn't necessarily benefit very much from the 3D screen, and they're not going to use the added horsepower of the system all that much.
I mean, you think if you were doing something digital, you know, I mean, if you just took essentially a side-scrolling, you know, pixel art kind of game, but just, you know, I understand Shantae has loads of parallax in it, you know, for instance, and just translated those parallax layers into layers in the stereoscopic display, I think people would appreciate that if the game design's good enough.
You're right, but Hatsworth and Monster Tail don't use that much parallax.
No, they don't. But
they use a little bit, but not...
I think that's not too much of a stretch to imagine from where they are to where they could go on 3DS, rather than, like, you know, something that's like a side-scrolling game, but with like polygonal graphics or something like that. I certainly don't see them going there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, but I think you can lean too heavily on parallax, and I've played games where parallax, there were too many layers and it was distracting, and just doesn't, that, the layers can conflict with each other very easily and look weird, and I think once you expand those into 3D layers with a stereoscopic screen, it could be even more distracting. So I don't necessarily think that's an easy solution. I think it could be done very well in certain games, but, you know, like, if you look back at, like, Wario Land on Virtual Boy, that had two layers of parallax and one color, and it was still sometimes difficult to...
And in that, you played in the different planes, rather than just background layers.
Yeah, but you multiply that times five layers and full color graphics, and it could be just visually too busy.
It'd be interesting to see. I would like to see it in action.
It would be interesting, yeah. Well, it can't. It's got to be a matter of time.
Well, I mean, you could even see it 3D classics. I mean, you know, with certain games on, you know, Super NES game that had a heavy use of parallax, we could see it just there, not even in an original game. See how it turns out.
Yeah, you can make ActRaiser 2 even harder.
No, we're good.
A lot of parallax in that game.
How about we just give us back the city building stuff and we'll call it a day?
Well, lucky for you, James, I think ActRaiser 2 is probably the least likely game to be released as a 3D classic. So
it doesn't even manage to penetrate the virtual console. I think it's pretty unlikely.
So James has the next letter.
Oh, good.
It's ranty. It's a perfect choice for James.
RW writes, I just bought a 3DS, immediately downloaded the eShop channel, and I was pretty disappointed in Nintendo to see the software is not even a dollar amount, yet we're forced to make credit purchases in increments of 5, 10, 15, 20. No cent amount. Basically, you buy a game and you're left with a penny. Buy another game and now you have two at the end of your account. Two pennies. In essence, you'd have to purchase 100 games to use all of your, quote, loose change. Guess what? That's never going to happen for about 99% of DSi/3DS owners. Sure, it's not a big deal for me and you to be out maybe 25 cents over a handheld's lifetime, but do the math and multiply that by the install base and you'll see Nintendo is making hand over fist with leftover change. Isn't there something we could do to stop from being nickel and dimed?
Yes, we could take a printer out in the field and kick it while listening to gangster rap
That's
music.
That's right.
You know what else we could do? Pay taxes on your purchases.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, RW apparently didn't. And that's the interesting part of this is that when I buy stuff on the eShop, it charges me sales tax. So I end up with, instead of 1 cent left over, I end up with 76 cents left over.
Well,
whatever.
Look, that's faster to your next game. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you look at a game on the eShop, does it tell you the price plus tax?
No. No, it tells me $3.99. I don't know how much tax I'm paying until, I mean, if I had a calculator and I knew my local.
What if you're short then?
No. Well, it'll show you once it gets to the, are you sure you want to buy this screen?
Oh.
But no, I mean, it won't tell you at the menu when you're browsing through games. No.
Oh, okay.
So I think you kind of have to, well, it's like you're buying anything else in America. You have to have a little more money than it says on the price tag. I mean, it's, I don't think it's that unusual of a shopping experience for most people.
Yeah. See, I mean, with us, the VAT sales tax, that is built into the price.
Japan is like that too.
One way you could fix this problem is you could have a European 3DS in which there are no weird, like, 99 increments. Everything is in 10 pence increments. But the weird thing is that it makes you buy stuff in blocks of £10, which is quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And also, they are blocks. I mean, you compare it to, like, the PSN, which has a cash system. With that, you have to put at least, I think, £5 into your wallet. You know, so if you wanted to buy, like, a download pack or something, like, you'd end up having to put £5 into your PSN wallet in order to pay for that tiny little download. But over and above that, it just takes out the amount that it is. So if I wanted to buy Beyond Good and Evil for £8, it would just be £8.
And it's the same thing in America with PSN.
And I think that is a more elegant way of dealing with, like, well, okay, well, we don't want to deal in all these tiny little transactions. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit unfortunate that they've gone this way. It seems, you know, if you're going to a cash system, it almost seems like that would be one of the things you would expect from it. And we haven't got that. It's still very much like buying blocks of points.
It's more honest, but
that's a bit annoying. But this whole change thing, well, we don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, I don't think Nintendo's getting rich off of this. I think you're overreacting to that, RW. But I can see you being annoyed by it. Again, it doesn't affect me because I have to pay sales tax on it. So you should be thankful that your state doesn't, or your zip code doesn't charge sales tax.
That's
so
right.
You're actually saving a lot more than I am.
Sales tax that might not be potentially legal depending on congressional action coming up. We'll see.
It's in flux, yes.
Also, although this is not a technically factually accurate statement, you can go ahead and thank the competitive Chicago newspaper scenes of the 1870s for your 99 cent scenario.
Oh, really? Did they actually
There's a well-worn story that's not possibly true.
Apocryphal.
Yeah, that a newspaper wanted to compete with the 5 cent newspaper, so he made a 1 cent newspaper. But since all the prices were in even dollars back then and there was no sales tax, he had to convince merchants to lower their price by 1 cent. So the government would have to make more pennies, so more pennies would be in circulation. Whether or not this is legitimate.
That is really, really complicated.
Now, all of these events did transpire. There was a penny newspaper. That was his goal. He did try to convince.
But the idea that this guy tricked the government into making more pennies so he could sell his 1 cent newspaper is so ludicrous.
It exercises of Darth Sidious like foresight and scope just to charge a cent for a newspaper.
It really does.
Darth Sidious.
I think it's basic consumer psychology. 99 cents doesn't seem like a dollar, even though it essentially is. I mean, I sympathize with RW in that I think when clearly you're not using, even though they say this is a cash-based system, you're not actually using cash to buy things on the eShop. You're using a credit card, okay?
I missed the points.
Or you're going to a store and buying a card, in which case you're paying tax anyway, etc. But when you are doing this all digitally, probably linked to a credit card purchase, you know, if something costs $5.17 and I put it on my credit card, that 17 cents is not an inconvenience to me. I don't have to rummage for change in the tray in my car for 17 cents because it's on a credit card. So because I'm buying things on the eShop with a credit card anyway, I would prefer that they just charge me $5 flat.
Hallelujah. Mm-hmm. But the DSiWare games are actually 1 cent cheaper because Nintendo shaved a point off all the prices.
That's right.
There you go. There's your missing point.
A discount that you'll never be able to use, RW.
There you go. They weren't hurting you. They were giving you a gift. A gift of 0.07% of your purchase for Miami Nights DSiWare.
Well, no, they're giving him a penny, but they're not actually giving it to him because he can't use it. So
we'll
they're giving
you.
It to him, but he's keeping it. It's the false discount. It's kind of genius, actually.
This is yours, but yeah, we're going to hold on to it for now.
And let me just to put things in perspective, having 1 or 2 cents left over after you buy a couple things is much better than on the Wii Shop having 100 points left over. That's a whole dollar that you'll never spend.
Yeah, that you can't ever do anything with.
You can't even buy a Rock Band song with 100 points.
Yeah. I said that with the European one, though, you're really quite often at risk of having weird amounts left over because they make you buy increments of £10, right? Mm-hmm. But as I said, in terms of pounds to dollars, it's a 0.9 system. So essentially, you're buying $11 worth of stuff. Which doesn't really kind of, it's difficult to make those work quite as neatly.
I want to press the pause button real quick here. So there are WiiWare games, and I believe there's also one DSiWare game, that's 1,200 points.
Yeah, which with £10.80.
So you have to do two purchases to get
just to make up the 80 pence.
Son of a bitch.
So you have a lot worse off than we do.
That's awful.
It'll balance out in the end, I guess.
You're going to spend it in the look, in the steady state, Greg will spend enough money to make it work out.
Yes.
But the average person may not. So.
I really want Shantae, but I don't want to enter my credit card information twice.
Is one of those things, the fact that I still have 100 points on my Pal Wii is one of the reasons. So I haven't blown my own head off because I just think, well, they win, don't they?
The hilarious thing is when you think about how much money you've given to Nintendo over your lifetime, that you could be upset about $1, one pound, or much less 5 cents.
Is it
so
in every sense petty?
I'm pretty sure I've sent at least one Nintendo employee's child to college at this point, so I'm not going to fret over a few cents. So I've got the last email this week. Chris from Chicago writes, "Since the 3DS was released, I've been baffled and frankly annoyed by how the gaming media have treated the system's graphical effects in reviews and on podcasts. Over and over, the only evaluation of the use of 3D is how it changes gameplay."
See us 2.5 hours ago.
I tried to stop you. "If the 3D effect doesn't have a huge effect on how the game is played, it is deemed a failure, or even worse, an annoyance. This methodology seems fundamentally flawed to me. The 3D effect is a graphical enhancement, just like high definition. Its intent is to make a game more attractive. I've never heard anyone lament that HD graphics do not change the way a game is played. Rather, people simply consider the presence of high definition to be a positive. Why do you think the 3D effect of the 3DS is held to a different standard?"
Actually, Nintendo has lamented that HD graphics do not change the way
yes.
it is played. I saw those press conferences. It's happened.
And Nintendo overpromised the potential for 3D graphics to affect gameplay.
We've alluded to it a bit with the Super Mario stuff, but even before that, just that developer voice thing that we had a year ago, mm-hmm.
right?
We had a bunch of people, not just Nintendo developers from the Japanese industry, from the Western markets coming to think of the possibilities that we have now with the auto-stereoscopic display and all that. There's quite a lot of promises sort of inferred, at least, if not made in a hard manner, that it would change gameplay. So it's natural that people focus on that. There's also the issue of performance trade-offs. So, if you've got something like Dead or Alive, for instance, with the whole 60 frames in 2D, 30 frames in 3D, then people might think that trade-off would be more palatable if there were also a gameplay kind of benefit to it as well.
Well, that's only a trade-off if you actually care about 3D. And I think it's funny that probably a lot of the complaints about that frame rate thing in Dead or Alive were probably made by people who didn't want to play that game in 3D anyway. So
may very well be the case.
That's silly.
Yeah. I mean, for me, see, I do appreciate the 3D on the level of just it's visually pleasing.
It's pretty.
I've played Dead or Alive almost exclusively in the 3D mode. As I said when I talked about it a couple of weeks ago, just because I like the look of it better that way. So there's certainly, I think in the midst of scrutinizing whether it actually does do anything for gameplay or whatever, that part of it, just the fact that it looks good, has probably been a bit de-emphasized, but there is a difference between this and HD. Although there are ways in which I would argue that HD has enhanced gameplay. I've talked about, you know, the sort of observation based platforming that you get in something like Assassin's Creed,
yeah,
which really is not possible in quite the same way if you don't have graphics of that fidelity displayed at that resolution.
Well, and the real-time strategy games that James likes to play, you're not going to do those on a Game Boy screen.
Well, and also it's also
I've
helped.
Tried actually. It's not fun.
It's also helped with, you know, to really push forward open world games as well, because just the worlds are more beautiful and they're more realistic, believable, or even fantastic worlds, you know, fantasy worlds just look better.
Well, like when I talked about Tales of Vesperia, it was amazing mm-hmm. with all the color.
Yeah.
I mean, it was jaw-dropping.
Yeah, I mean, HD doesn't make a huge difference in certain things, and it depends a lot on the art style, and it depends on how the developer uses it. And I think 3D is the same way. I think Chris is totally right in drawing a parallel here between 3D and HD. They're done very much the same way. I mean, I think there's a big gap between 3D done well and 3D done poorly, and same with HD. And I think they both primarily just make a game more attractive. I mean, it makes you want to play a game, right? I mean, I think back to a number of times. Like, I remember Smash Brothers Melee, the first time I saw that at E3 10 years ago. The main reason I wanted to play it was because it looked amazing. I rented the original Smash Bros. On N64. Granted, I mainly played it by myself, but I really didn't care for it that much. And to this day, it's my least favorite Smash Bros. But the gorgeous graphics, they still look fantastic on Melee, drew me to that game and made me want to play it, because here were all of my favorite Nintendo characters drawn to a level of detail that I'd never seen before. And it made me want to play that game, and once I did, I found out that I really like that game. And I think that game plays better than the original too. But the same is going to happen on Wii U. Now we have all of our Nintendo characters drawn in yet another level of detail that we've never seen before. And for some of the characters, look, for Kirby, it won't matter. Kirby looks the same in any resolution, okay?
I want to see all of the no pores on his head.
Well, and this is one of my problems with Kirby Wii, for instance, when I was arguing with Neil about how impressive that game was. I have a number of problems with Kirby Wii.
There's a lot of issues with Kirby Wii.
One of my problems with that game is that it essentially looks like Kirby 64.
That's not my biggest problem with Kirby Wii, but yeah, it is not an attractive game.
That was the nice thing about Epic Yarn, is that they said, well, how can we make Kirby look new and interesting on this more powerful hardware? Well, we can't just draw him exactly the same way that we always have, because he's a round pink ball.
I still the existence of this Wii game, which may or may not be very closely related to the GameCube game they were making all those years ago. you know, it should have been Yoshi's Epic Yarn. This is bullshit.
Well, Goodfield may very well be working on that.
Oh, I should. It's just, you know, he could use his tongue to unravel them, and
it could still come, Greg. They haven't had time.
They don't like him anymore.
Kirby came out 6 months ago. I mean, it's 9 months.
Consoling
ago.
Is not fitting.
It's not working.
The show.
No.
So what for me? I mean, you don't have to make Kirby himself look good. You can make the world look better, and they don't really do much of that either.
There's that too. Yeah.
I mean, Kirby can just be a pink ball if the world looks nice. It's fine. Whatever.
I mean, one thing I think that I've kind of come to appreciate with the 3DS in terms of the benefit of 3D, you know, I don't know, with my limited experience of like glasses 3D, you know, on a big television screen, it's difficult for me to say that feels more immersive. But with the 3DS, I think it is. Because it's a portable device, and therefore, by its nature, it's not necessarily that immersive, you know? Mm-hmm. You're kind of aware that you're holding this thing in your hands and you're looking at a screen. But when you feel like you're looking into it, something like Ocarina does just feel more like, even though it's a portable system, you're kind of getting sucked into it in the way you would if you was playing a game on a big screen TV with surround sound, but by a different route, but the effect is similar.
I think with Ridge Racer, some people actually literally feel like they're being sucked into it, and that's why I think you hear a lot of people turning off the 3D or turning it down in Ridge Racer, because it's so strong, it's so well done that it's almost unsettling.
It's very good in Ridge Racer.
It is really well done, yeah. I play it with it all the way up, because I'm a man.
You know how much testosterone's flowing through those retinas.
Yeah.
It's Vin Dieseling.
I'm actually going to mod my 3DS so the 3D slider goes up a little higher, and I'm going to write 11 by it.
Yeah.
So I can play Ridge Racer like a rock god.
Why don't you just make 10 more 3D-er?
3D-er?
That may actually happen on 3DS Lite. We'll
how many E's are in the pronunciation of 3D-er, John?
I don't know. Let me research that.
But, you know, I think Greg has a great point. And the other thing, and I think this is often forgotten about why the 3DS works so well and what makes it so much better to look at than a 3D movie screen or a 3D TV screen, is not only the lack of glasses, but it's the fact that it's non-polarized 3D. So it doesn't have the light output problem. These games are bright and vivid and colorful because they're not cutting out 50% of the light so that they can direct it to each eye. And yes, it has the sweet spot problem, so you can get ghosting and you can get crossover if you don't hold it right. But if you do have it held correctly, this is probably the best that a 3D display will ever look. I mean, this technology, I think, is probably the ideal way to do it because they're not sacrificing picture quality or light output to do it. And that's a big part of why it looks so good. And I think it's why it looks different than 3D on other displays, because it's just, it's a more natural way to do it. It works with the way that your eyes already work, which is that they see things from two different angles. And I think that technology can probably be improved. You know, I think they can make it look more natural. They can make the sweet spot bigger with new versions of the technology, but I think this is the way to go in the future. I think this will last longer than the goofy glasses, because polarized 3D is really a cheap workaround. But to get to the heart of Chris's question, why do you think the 3D effect is held to a different standard? For one thing, it's really the only game in town. I mean, this is the only, people don't know how to react to 3D. They don't know how to interpret it. They don't know how to value it.
So when I wrote my first 3DS review, I actually emailed Johnny going, Johnny, what the hell did you do when you had to do your first motion control review? Because I legitimately had no clue what the hell to say.
Yeah, we have to create a new vocabulary for how we evaluate these games, how we compare them, how we recommend them. And 3D is especially difficult because not everyone can even appreciate this effect, you know? And because it's so optional, you can just turn it down. You can even turn it partway down, which you can't do with HD, really.
Mm-hmm. I only want 680p.
Yeah. Well, then you should play Modern Warfare 2. But it's like...
I'm going to give that a heyo.
Come on. The problem with 3D is that it is very subjective, because it depends a lot on how you hold the system and how far up the slider goes and how good is your left-right vision symmetry. Is your vision corrected the way it's supposed to be?
How much of a man are you?
If I took my glasses off or took my contacts out, then I'd have a problem with 3D because my prescription is different from one eye to the other. And some people have that and don't know it because they don't go to the eye doctor often enough. I mean, these are really complicated factors that build into this. And again, people aren't used to seeing 3D. It's still a fairly new technology for the mainstream. And the way 3DS does it is different than other versions of 3D that are out there. So people don't really understand how to communicate about it. And people aren't sure what they think about it. I feel like it looks pretty cool. I mean, the 3D alone is not the reason that I bought the system, but it's part of it, and I appreciate it.
I would say some games look pretty cool. Some, like, Combat of the Dinosaurs.
Well, the thing is,
Combat of the Dinosaurs is the only game with 99 Street Pass slots.
I mean, the reason why 3D gets picked on is because, I mean, the 3DS itself is sold on the 3D. So if the 3D isn't absolutely amazing, you're always going to have a certain segment of people saying, ah, whatever, it's crap. Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, it's a great game, but 3D's fucked.
Yeah,
so.
Like, that's the thing. It's partially Nintendo's fault. I mean, they built it up a little bit more than perhaps they should have. But then again, they have to do something to say that, hey, this is better than the DS.
This isn't just a numbers upgrade, because if you're going to do that, you just go get the other unfortunately named piece of hardware in the market.
I saw two things on my 3DS this week that really blew me away. The first, as corny as it is, was the Green Lantern 3D trailer that they put out for the movie. And I was skeptical of this. First off, I think the movie looks very questionable.
That's being kind.
But it's the first, like, movie trailer that I've seen on my 3DS. And, you know, one of the weird things about the video content that they're putting out is that you can't adjust the 3D. It's on or off. Because of the way that 3D cameras that are used to shoot this footage, they work differently than a code running in the background of an interactive game where you can do all that stuff in real time. These aren't real time. So I thought, well, that's going to make it harder to find the sweet spot, etc. But when I watched it, I was really impressed at how good the 3D effect was on that video. The other thing I saw this week is the puzzle pictures that you get in Street Pass mode. I had completed all of these last week at E3 because we had so many Street Passes. So I had all these, but I hadn't actually looked at them yet.
Oh, you hadn't?
No, and they're and I realized that these are actually like the scenes they showed at E3
last year. These are the trophies.
Yeah. So they're not paintings. They're not photos like you would think. They're not just static images in 3D. They're dioramas that you can rotate the camera all around, and they look amazing. They look incredible. I think they're some of the best graphics on the system right now, period.
Clean up on Al Johnny.
Well, it was like seeing Melee on GameCube. I'll go back to that example because I thought that game looked miles ahead of anything else they showed on GameCube
did,
that
did
year.
Did you hear that, Nintendo? Johnny wants a game about dioramas. Make it happen.
Well, no, it reminds me a lot of, you know, because when you pause in Melee, you can rotate the camera around. It's very similar effect, actually. And it gets up on the detail, and it looks really incredible. And I think it's very much the same thing. So if you've gotten any, if you've completed any of those 3D so-called photos or pictures in the Street Pass mode, definitely take the time to go look at them and rotate the camera around. That shows you the real graphical power of the 3DS. And I think we're still waiting for real games to actually hit that mark, but hopefully they will, because I think the 3DS graphical power is a lot greater than what we've seen so far. Resident Evil Revelations and Nano Assault are probably the two games that come the closest to the Street Pass pictures. And so I think there's a lot of room to grow in terms of 3DS visuals. I think it's going to get a lot better over the next couple of years. All right. Well, that was a lot of emails that we just went through. Thank you, everybody, for writing in. We actually couldn't get to everything. We even got some that I wasn't able to fit into the show. We might try to catch up on some of those next week, but of course we'll be getting new ones as well. So no guarantees, but I do want to thank everybody who wrote in, and I hope that you will consider writing in as well. The address, once again, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Next up, just a quick reminder that we will be returning to Retroactive next week and finishing up Perfect Dark with a single-player campaign.
Hey!
The forum thread is still open. I do encourage you to go by and leave your thoughts there. We're still coming up. We're now 3 episodes away from the RFN 5-year 250th episode anniversary.
It's coming.
So we are working on plans for that, but once again, if you have ideas and requests for what you'd like to have us do, email those in. Let us know. I would definitely like to hear. You can also drop us a line on facebook.com/Radio Free Nintendo. You can hit us up on Twitter. You know those names, I'm sure. And in the talkback for the article on NintendoWorldReport.com. And for plugs, we had a new newscast go out right before E3. That's a little outdated at this point, and it's really short, too. But more importantly, the Homecast went out during E3, and that's on the newscast feed. So if you're not subscribed to that, you may not have heard it yet. Definitely go by and check that out. I believe that is Zach and Carl and Obi. So a couple of former RFN...
Where's Rock Band?
A couple of RFN alumni, along with Zach Miller from Newscast, and it was the first time that he'd been on Newscast in a few weeks, so you can catch back up with him as well. But it's them reacting to everything that went on at E3. Radio Trivia, I don't have an update for you. Unfortunately, we did not have time to record an episode, even though we were staying with TYP, because E3 is that crazy, y'all. But I'm sure Mike has been thinking about it, and hopefully we'll have a new episode of that coming up pretty soon. And I just did a box office poison with Carl, Mike, and Stan, all people you know from years past on Radio Free Nintendo. And we talked about Super 8 and X-Men and Tree of Life. So a little something for everybody there. So definitely go check that out. It's over at crosstalk.com with a W. That's all, folks. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. All right, John is up first.
All right, with our E3 coverage, did you hear about Final Fantasy, Bitrip on a Disc, Retro Studios' current project, or the new Professor Layton? Even if you check the site every day, you probably missed a few things. Carly puts together an article called E3 2011 Highlights, and you can find it in our news section.
What the fuck?
And also, with our E3 video roundup, Ultimate Edition. Jared destroyed E3 with his video coverage, and now you can find every single one of those clips embedded in a single article.
I think John's appendix just exploded.
Next, we have the Wii Super NES Classic Controller. Nick reviews this Club Nintendo reward available to fortunate fans in Australia and Europe and Japan and several other places not called America. It's a Super Nintendo controller for your Wii.
That's what I heard.
Yeah.
Yep, it is what it is. I've seen the pictures.
The pictures.
Oh, you've opened up Pandora's box now. If you're gonna find John's cadence laugh out loud funny, then can't get away with pictures, can you?
It wasn't his cadence. It was the fact he was in pain. There was physical pain.
Sometimes I just explode from now playing goodness.
There was a moment where I thought, oh, John's going to start this over. And then he did.
Because he hates me.
John, what are you going to talk about here?
Chrono Trigger.
Okay.
No, this will be the last time, though. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
This is it.